The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
You basically lost two All-Ireland down in one season. It's only 9 months since we lost the last one.
Only Mayo could lose two All-Ireland in one season.
Yeah, that's going to be cool, isn't it?
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
OTB AM. With Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
It's 7:30. This is Thursday morning. You're very welcome along to OTBAM. It's Ger Gilroy and Kenny Cunningham with you. Kenny, welcome back.
Morning, Ger.
In live, glorious Technicolor in studio. How are you?
All good. All good.
It's been a minute.
And the rest?
Did you have a good pandemic? How was it? How was it for you?
On a scale of 1 to 10, like most people, I think about 1.5.
All right. Well, as pandemics go, you know, we're all... Well.
Golf's getting better. Chipping away the golf game. That's got to be said. Every cloud.
Oh, yeah?
Et cetera, et cetera.
Do you have an official handicap?
I don't.
Right.
That's why I like it, Jess. That's why I like it.
You can duck and dive a little bit?
I can.
What? How do you measure that it's getting better? How do you know? You just feel it?
Just a reaction of people I'm playing with. How nobody will talk to me coming off the 18th.
Okay. And now they're like, oh, that was actually not too bad.
No, I must admit, I haven't played a bit more golf, to be honest. And I have been enjoying it, must admit.
Finally, an outlet for your competitive urge.
Well, it's always been an outlet, to be honest with you, but not in a good way.
Right.
A lot of the time, yeah.
Just to take
a reasonably frustrating game, Jay. I'm not sure if you're...
Yeah. No, familiar with that.
Yeah. But, yeah, I've kind of parked my demons somewhat over the past couple of years,
And
just embraced the, you know...
The chaos.
Better parts of the game.
Yeah, a bit like...
The camaraderie, you know, social side.
The fact that you're outdoors for a long period of time.
Yeah, indeed, yeah.
That's all you want.
And appreciating some of the golf courses that we have over this fair land of ours.
Yeah, they're good.
Oh my God, unbelievable.
They are, absolutely. Right, if anybody has any questions for Kenny this morning, 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. Of course, you can always leave a comment for us on the YouTube stream. We should just delve straight into the Champions League. On the whole, before we get into any of the specifics, a good start over the last couple of days, a welcome return of the best quality football that we see really ever, is it?
Let's park the best quality of football as well and just say that, yeah, I did enjoy the last two nights' football. Yeah, came back, was more crash, bang, wallop the last two nights. I was working on the Manchester United game. That was interesting for a few different reasons. Then obviously Liverpool last night, yeah, was really enjoyable. It was... Yeah, it's been a while now since I sat in front of the telly. Having left the telly almost during the game, was one of those games last night against Milan. Just atmosphere inside the stadium was just like, oof, just coming out of the TV, dripping out of the TV, wasn't it?
We missed that, it turns out. So when football came back after the first lockdown, we were very grateful to have anything, but it wasn't really football, was it?
Yeah, and even those kind of, we got 400 people in the main stands, just to have a few people, wasn't quite buying into that one either, to be honest with you. You know, even visually looking at those stadiums, even kind of quarter, half full for me, it just, you know, not really. But, that last night was, that was pretty special last night at Anfield.
Who was Jordan Henderson making the sounds to? Was it like... I wasn't in the team at the weekend, and you took a little bit of...
You didn't think I was worth 280 grand? You only thought I was worth 260? Yeah, really?
That's what it was, the contract?
I don't know.
Because I was wondering, it was like, it took them a while, they got there eventually in the end, you know?
Yeah. It was not an obvious one, actually. Spoke to a couple of Liverpool supporters, what Liverpool do, bloody ass Jordan Henderson, but... I can understand maybe Liverpool's reluctance to commit. I don't know how long the contract was in the end. It's obviously one of the bounds of contention was a 3 years, Jared. I don't know. Obviously, Henderson's looking for as long a contract as he wants, and there's big money at play there. But Jordan Henderson wouldn't be the first high profile player at his age at a big club who, you know, signed a three, four year contract, and within 12 to 18 months had kind of dropped off a cliff, but in terms of performance, you know, serious dip, deterioration in terms of, you know, their physical condition, etc., and their kind of impact in the squad. So I understood Liverpool's reluctance to commit to that length of a contract on those terms.
His contract will now expire on June 30th, 2025. So that's 4 years from now, but it might have only added on an extra 1 year as opposed to being added on an extra 2, but it's plenty.
Oh, it's plenty for him. And yeah, what you do, what you have now is you have a happy camper around the change room, although I didn't look particularly happy, like you say, after he hit that goal last night. It was a sweet strike, wasn't it?
Yeah. And it's also, like, so obviously the injury happens at the weekend and they're like, yeah, we'll put our most experienced player, our captain, back in the team. It's the squad depth is an issue at Liverpool, and it will become an issue over the course of the rest of the season if they continue to have significant long-term injuries. But at the moment, they can deal with it.
Yeah, and that was Liverpool for me last night in terms. It was no coincidence the way Liverpool started the game. You know, we all know, kind of high energy, high intensity, you know, high press, swarming around people, that high defensive line. But that can only be effective if you get the right kind of personnel on the pitch. And this is the interesting debate about Liverpool the last year or so in terms of different players who've come into the team, particularly in that central midfield area. But I don't think it was any surprise. I think Klopp was looking to really come out of blocks last night and really impose himself on Milan, actually overrun them, kind of suffocate them. So it was no surprise Thiago was parked on the bench last night and Keita came into the team, because Liverpool have been at their best. That central midfield for me, obviously the front three to an extent, but that central midfield is key in terms of their energy, their kind of physicality, their kind of high intensity, how they almost maul opponents. That's how they won their first league title. And we saw that last night in the presence of Henderson, Fabinho and Keita. Keita's had a difficult time, but he's got legs. You know, he's physical, he's kind of aggressive. Didn't have a great game last night, but he kind of contributed. So that was more the Liverpool blueprint, DNA, whatever you want to call it, that's been successful for them over the past couple of years. Yeah, let's take last year out of the equation to a small extent. We know the circumstances there. But so that's Liverpool I'd like to see.
Were you surprised to see Origi start? Because he doesn't really start these big games.
Yeah, you're right. A little bit surprised. But again, what I'd say is legs, can get around the pitch, can start that press, can go and engage opposition, centre-halves, and can do it continually over the course of 90 minutes, you know what I mean? So he wasn't bringing in a player who was going to weaken. For me, what drove that team sheet last night was how Liverpool out possession. We need to be perfect out possession in terms of how we hunt this team down. These are good football inside Milan. Got some very talented individual players, like to play the game at kind of their pace. So Liverpool had to kind of counteract that, and they have the team to do it in terms of that kind of tenacity that we're talking about, that kind of high energy. And I think Origi kind of provided that, albeit a little bit higher up the pitch.
Yeah. So it's clear that they're trying to manage the minutes of the players. There's no Virgil last night. And it's a similar number of changes and a similar approach to the game that Manchester United took. But there's a difference in the quality of the teams at the moment. Maybe not in the quality of the personnel, but there's certainly a difference in terms of the team understanding what they're trying to do, what their identity is.
Yeah, but Klopp made the changes last night, but the balance of the team for me wasn't affected. Van Dijk coming out, Gomez coming in, fundamentally nothing changes. Obviously, yeah, in terms of the qualities of Van Dijk, I understand that, but in terms of really the balance of the team, the midfield three for me was strengthened actually by Henderson coming into the Van der Beek came into the Manchester United team the other night. Pogba got shifted out onto the left wing, playing left of a three. So the balance, that shift, the shifts the whole balance of the Manchester United. It's a skew now, where the changes Liverpool made last night, that wasn't the case. Even Origi going centrally and Jota coming onto the left hand side, fundamentally the balance of the team didn't change. And like I said, in the engine room, in that central area of the pitch, Liverpool were strengthened for me. You mentioned about strength and depth, maybe to an extent. I mean, I'm a big fan of Curtis Jones. I've got to be honest with you, the last year or so, I thought there was a time last year he was actually going to break through and hold down a place in that central midfield. I think potentially he could be the best Liverpool all-round central midfield in the next 2 to 3 years. He's developing to play. He's got a bit of everything physically. He's more mature now. I think the defensive side to the game is improving, which it has to do because of the things that we've been talking about, what you have to do in that central midfield area for Liverpool. And he's a very technical player, and he's got legs, and he's got an end product in terms of goals. So when we talk about those other Liverpool central midfield players, whether it's Fabinho, Henderson, Thiago's kind of ball playing, his technical ability, but kind of no legs, can't trust him defensively. But Curtis Jones for me is potentially the one, I think, who can actually step in to that Liverpool midfield, certainly over, even this year I'm looking at. Even last night when he came on, I was impressed with him. You know, real confidence when he came on the pitch, going and getting on the ball. He's got legs he can get around the pitch. I think he's a real talent and really interesting to see. I'd be interested to see how Klopp thinks about what he really thinks about him. I know he'll come out publicly and say, oh yeah, great talent, we love him here, blah blah blah.
You
at the end of the day,
how big the games are going to be that he picks him.
Yeah, yeah, minutes on the pitch, ultimately it's all about minutes. You can talk about how much I trust me player, yeah, I love him, oh yeah, we're so lucky to have him, but you know, he, when the big games
might be available
come
for
along,
15 to 20 million.
Yeah, 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 exactly. But I'm a big fan, so you're talking about strength and depth. For me, he's the one. Harvey obviously showed up well early in the season, but Jones is the one for me in that kind of central midfield area who could really break through. I know a lot of people talk about Thiago, but for me it's Jones is the one for me who can actually elevate Liverpool potentially.
So in theory they can actually take injuries at this point to almost anybody with the exception of Salah. Is that kind of what we feel about Liverpool?
It depends what you mean they can't take an injury to Salah.
Well
they miss him obviously in terms of his
none
his
of the
goals,
replacements they have for
that's
him.
What you're talking about.
Like take Salah out of the team and they're definitely a significantly weakened side. Most of the great sides.
Yeah, that's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Well, he's reached that level now where if he's not on the team sheet, the opposition goes, we have a chance, but if he isn't the team sheet, you're very concerned about it. I suppose what I'm saying is the squad is big enough to deal with almost any injuries.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. Well, that's the beauty of Jota in particular coming in. He's very versatile. Jota can operate anywhere across the front three and even in behind. So you talk about Salah coming out of the team and yeah, absolutely, in terms of his numbers speak for themselves, but I don't think it's a case, well, who have we got to play right side of a three? I mean, Jota predominantly just slides over there, like, you know what I mean? I don't think he can, you know, don't give your chin to be on the floor. As a Liverpool supporter, Diego Jota was popping up right side of a three, Mane and potentially kind of Firmino as well, so yeah, you can always make that. What if they lose? Yeah, what if they lose Van Dijk again? Yeah, what if they lose Henderson for a long period of time?
If they lose Van Dijk again, have they got enough now that Matip and Gomez are back and they've signed Konate and like
they've got enough to challenge. If you ask me, they've got enough to challenge for the title.
Yeah,
yeah, like, absolutely.
Yeah, that's the thing because like obviously last year they didn't have enough. The squad wasn't deep enough.
Well, no, but they had those key instrumental figures missing for a long period. Van Dijk in particular was absolutely huge, and obviously some significant injuries apart from that. That was pretty exceptional. Very difficult to plan over the course of a season for losing key players for such a long period of time. But I like to look at the squad. I like to look at the squad. Now it hasn't been a huge amount of investment. Canate is a good player, actually. I like him. Haven't seen a lot of him yet, but they have been strengthened there, so no, I wouldn't be overly critical. I know a few Liverpool supporters, a little bit weak here and there. I don't see any obvious weaknesses in terms of the strength of the squad, and everybody, as key players, as with any team, keep fit for the majority of the season, key parts of the season. I think they'll be fine, and I expect them to be challenging.
The third generation of Maldini's obviously coming on last night with about 10 minutes left to go. If something's going to make you feel old, I presume that was it?
I know, centre forward, wasn't he? I've seen a little bit of him play, actually, to be honest with you. Yeah, you can see the similarities there, couldn't you? Must be a killer for the old man. First touch, actually, tried a little something, didn't come off. It's got to be one of them. You're grimacing a little bit of the old man in the stadium. But
So Liverpool are in rude health. They're able to make changes. They still win, even though they're up against a side who give them their fill of it in Europe. They've got to be pretty happy with life at the moment.
Yeah, I think so. In comparison, where they were, roller coaster of a season last year. Yeah, absolutely.
What about City last night? So you score 6 at home in the Champions League. The music is great. Your new star player is coming off buzzing afterwards, saying he can take on anybody one on one in the world, and you still concede 3. What? How do they feel about this? Do they feel great about life?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, 6 goals shouldn't be. I don't think we should be that surprised. Not as strong a Leipzig side as has been around previously, but that's what they're capable of. That's the quality which they have high up the pitch. These are the type of combinations that they can put on the pitch. That kind of front five, you'd kind of compare it, I suppose, to Liverpool last night. This is what I'm talking about, Liverpool DNA last night. What that suits Liverpool best is when they're at their very best. But you look at the Manchester City front five, and in particular I'd compare the two Manchester City number eights to the two Liverpool number eights. Liverpool played with Henderson and Keita in those two advanced number eight positions. you know, Manchester City put De Bruyne and was it Bernardo Silva, usually Gundogan, in those, you know, different types, different beasts, you know, so that kind of dictates in terms of how you play your football. Manchester City play a different brand of football at times to Liverpool. There's significant differences there. Both can be equally effective, as we've seen. They both won two league titles, and that's the kind of, that's the comparison. That's the real interest for me. That kind of style of football suits City in terms of the individual qualities they have. For me, what we saw in Liverpool last night, that's the type of football Liverpool need to play and stick to that, and that's what really gets under Manchester City's skin. But getting back to your original point, Manchester City can be equally effective playing their style of football, and Grealish for me is it's no surprise, like a little bit surprised, maybe not a little bit surprised, Manchester City jumped, just because that type of player, obviously they haven't numbered him in their squad. I was very surprised, maybe I think anybody really, I think any of the top teams, I was surprised weren't tripping over themselves to get Grealish into the squad. You've mentioned maybe Liverpool, I mean he's the type of player for me, you've got to jump, you've got to grab him.
Yeah.
You know, normally you'd say, well, how does he fit in our style of play? Does he complement? And I understand that's generally the case 95% of the time when you're looking to bring in a player, even a high profile player. But Grealish is one for me that you got to get him. You got to get him in the door, and then you decide where you're going to play him. I think he's that good.
Yeah. So is he better than Jadon Sancho? Is he more suited?
I think he's a different type of player. I think he's the best around. He's better than Raheem Sterling for me, I'll tell you that. That's why he's playing. When push comes to shove, I think if he plays in those wide areas for Manchester City, I think he'll play left of a three, and he'll probably play ahead of Raheem Sterling, just because he's a different type of player. He's a highly tactical player. You can trust him with the ball. Decision making, his kind of intelligence, I think there's differences there with Sterling, more kind of a more explosive, kind of more blinkered in his approach. Sterling doesn't quite see pictures like Grealish does. And then of course there's that versatility. I'm still looking forward to seeing him play in those central midfield positions, those two number eights we're talking about. Still think potentially he could play there as long as he picks up a bit of slack defensively.
Definitely play there, I've no doubts about that. Having watched him for Villa, like he would end up in those positions a lot in the game.
Yeah, but he only played there as a 10 for Villa predominantly, Ger, you know, and that
when they're out of possession though, he ended up kind of having to defend a good bit too. Like it wasn't like there was no responsibility, and even in the Championship as well, like it's the fact that he's played so many games and had to be responsible in all of them that the whole team was always looking to him to perform, and the vast majority of times he did do it. I think that we underestimate the value of that sometimes.
Yeah, well, I didn't know that. I think he was a little bit loose. I think he was a bit ill-disciplined in his positional sense at Manchester City, Aston Villa, but there's reasons for that, like you were saying. Huge amount of responsibility on him, you know, not receiving enough of the ball, having to drift into areas of the pitch.
Yeah, people would have said the same with Gerrard at times, or even
I understand it.
England, you know?
Yeah, you're absolutely. So now he's looking around the pitch and he knows, even if he's playing left side of three, trust other people to get on the ball and find them in the areas where he can hurt the opposition.
He's never played with anybody as good as De Bruyne or Phil Foden or any of those guys.
Yeah, absolutely, so that'll elevate his game even more for me, and it'll get him into areas of the pitch where he can better influence the game, you know, that kind of tour, that, you know, last tour to the pitch, because I think his numbers have to improve in terms of his goals for a player of his quality. We saw an indication of it last night. The goal that he scored last night was great, but that's where he needs to be more often, picking the ball up 5 yards outside the penalty box 1v1 and end product. I think that's where he can improve as well, but I think he will, because he'll find himself in those situations more and more at Manchester City.
So no concern for you that they conceded 3 last night in the Champions League, that there's a template there for other teams watching to go, or is that specifically because they're playing against a side who they know they're going to overwhelm over the course of the 90 minutes?
No, there's always that small concern with Manchester City. I think the concern going forward is in that a lot of talk about Manchester United and that kind of holding midfield position, that kind of defensive linchpin, the struggles they have. I'm not exactly sure of Manchester City either in that area of the pitch. Fernandinho's got an extra year, I think, but kind of approaching the twilight of his career, he's been the best there's been. I think he's still their best option that area of the pitch. I'm not a huge fan of Rodri, I've got to be honest with you. I think he's a very good ball playing midfield player, kind of quite technical, but I'm not blown over by him again in terms of the defensive qualities he has. And I think that's potentially an issue for Manchester City. They didn't play with one actually in the final against Chelsea and suffered. But even with Rodri in there, for me, he doesn't nail down that central area of the pitch when they haven't got the ball. Don't think he's the most athletic. I don't think he, look at him sometimes, he doesn't strike me as one who really enjoys the defensive side of the game, which Fernandinho does, and the very best in that position actually do. They love it, love being in there, breaking up attacks, making tackles, you know, seeing danger and giving that kind of screen in front. So I think that is one of the reasons, to be, if you're going to ask me the question, are three goals, should we be concerned? I think we should always be concerned to a certain extent Manchester City in terms of their defensive setup. I think it's improved. I think their kind of press has improved last year. They went away from that somewhat, came very passive out possession of the ball, and I think they suffered because of it. They got back to that last season, but I still think that kind of like I said, that central area of the pitch, somebody with that real kind of defensive mindset, I think it was being greedy. I think maybe they're just slightly short in that area of the pitch. It might be a small gripe, to be honest, but like you're saying,
well, it's
the very highest level when it really matters, when it counts.
Champions League final against a good manager who understands what they're trying to do. You know, you can see how that might become an issue. The other big result last night, obviously, was the 1-1 draw for Paris Saint-Germain and Bruges. So that one finished 1-1, and we got to see Mbappe, Neymar, and Messi together. And it's going to take time, naturally, or is this actually, you know? So put yourself back, right, back in the changing room, and you're the centre back, and that's your front three. And let's face it, they're not the hardest working front three when it comes to pressing and defending and getting back. How do you feel?
Well, it's going to be an issue. I think Pochettino was quoted as saying, look, we're not quite a team yet. And I'm sure that's one of the things that he's alluding to, because when you break that down, kind of what is a team? Well, to some extent, it's kind of your attitude and your application on the pitch, taking personal responsibility for your role in the team. So I think that's what's being kind of part of a team. And as you've suggested there, you know, our possession, the work rate of those three players in particular is going to come under scrutiny, and it's going to be a factor if they're going to be successful. Forget about the domestic league, like, but saying if they're going to be successful in European competition, that's the Champions League, and go and win it. That's the intention of bringing these players in. That's going to be a factor. These players are going to have to dig in. But you know, Messi hasn't been digging in for Barcelona in that respect for the past couple of years. It just hasn't been expected of him. Like, I'm not sure physically if he can play at that level out of possession anymore. Neymar, feast or famine in that respect as well. So, yeah, I think it is an issue. And it is an issue for Pochettino, how he manages that. And if he can actually go through well and draw that out of Messi in particular, because it is going to hurt them. Now, you talk about the front three, that team sheet last night. Oh, you look at that front three. Well, you look at the midfield three, Andres Herrera, Paredes, can't remember, they've had a blank, the third one in there,
Wijnaldum.
I mean, that's a key area of the pitch. You know, we're talking about Liverpool last night, how good they were in the engine room.
Herrera started it, and Wijnaldum and Paredes come off. Paredes comes off at half time for Danilo Pereira. Ronaldo comes off at half time for Julian Draxler. And then Mbappe comes off after 51 minutes for Icardi.
Yeah, but it's not going to blow you away. That central midfield axis for me, no matter whoever three they put in there, I think there's question marks over that. I'll be looking at that midfield three saying, really, is that good enough in terms of what you look at what's around? The counterparts are going to be competing for the Champions League. So that'd be the biggest concern for me. I wouldn't get blown away from a couple of those other signs as well. Sergio Ramos, for me, does nothing for that team coming in. I'd be surprised if he plays, to be honest, which is better. There's better defenders at the club.
Well, Ramos isn't actually fit, I think, until October or November.
Yeah, so I suppose that's my point. So you look at those big, massive free transfers coming in. Hakimi, to be fair, like fine player. He'll improvement in that area of the pitch. But I think a number of those signs, for me, I'd be scratching my head in terms of, oh, yeah, wow, bang. You look at the name and you think, oh, this is pretty amazing what's happening at PSG. But realistically, for me, I think it's an argument for saying I don't think they've been particularly strengthened with the acquisition of a couple of these players.
Kehler playing in goals as well, so Donnarumma on the bench. So as a centre back, what do you think it will be like to play in that team at the moment?
I'll be, as a centre half, I'd be more concerned with that midfield three in front of me, to be honest with you, rather than the front three. I think players understand. I mean, they're not fools, and they'll realise Lionel Messi comes in, maybe to a small extent the same with Cristiano Ronaldo and Manchester United. That was a conversation after the game the other night. You know, feast or famine, the weekend, how well he played, well, the goals that he scored at the weekend, and in different circumstances against young boys, he showed his limitations, which he has now at the stage of a career that he's at, in terms of his energy levels, what he can do for the team in that situation. A man down, when you're expected to show a lot of energy, kind of run the channels and, you know, give that type of performance as a lone striker, he's not able to do that. But I think, you know, the Manchester United players and manager probably realised that when he came in. The same is true of Messi. I think it's always the case, as long as you really impact the game in other areas, you have to be impacting the game in other areas. Ronaldo has done that predominantly since he's been at the club. The goals he scored, albeit in a short period, and Messi's going to have to do that as well. As long as his numbers are up there in terms of goals and assists, and players look at him and think this lad could be the difference in those big games that you're talking about, Jared, coming up, the lads look at him and say, in any given day, this lad can just turn the game on its head and take us where we want to go in terms of Champions League finals. I think they'll suck it up, even if that means they've got to dig in and, you know.
Okay, so everybody's realistic about the fact that this increases my workload, but it might also increase my
absolutely, yeah. I think that's always been the case in the game. But of course, you know, when that's not the case and maybe they're not impacting the game and the attitude's a little bit and not really committing themselves to the cause, not being that type of team player that we're talking about, I think that can grade a little bit, and that's when the issues start within the dressing room, and that's when that can be very difficult to manage, even for a top manager.
All right, we'll talk about the Manchester United midfield situation in just a moment, but I just want to tell everybody that OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors. And the number to get involved in this morning, 0879 180 180, or you can just leave a comment on the YouTube stream if you're watching on YouTube. Of course, you can tweet us at OffTheBallAM. Here's what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock for you, talking about the Champions League, obviously. With Kenny, we've got the sports pages and an update on the Connacht Women's Rugby training ground fiasco situation from Will at about 8:05. Joe McMahon is going to talk to us from the Tyrone backroom team at 8:20. Sports news at 8:40. Harriet Pryor at 8:50 was at the Liverpool game last night. Our OTB TV picks with Sue. Final one for the foreseeable future. And then Luke Jensen on Emma Raducanu at 9:30 this morning. So if Cristiano Ronaldo at this stage of his career is not the out and out single striker that you want when you're down to 10 men, what about the midfielders of Fernandes and Pogba? They should have the energy levels to be able to manage a game. They certainly have the experience to manage a game when you're down to 10 men, and yet it didn't quite look like they were capable of doing it. The comparison that everybody's making is Chelsea get down to 10 men against Liverpool. Okay, so they gave up some chances, but they managed the game very professionally, like they'd been drilled to do it, like they knew what their jobs were and they understood what they were. That wasn't apparent after the Young Boys game.
Yeah. No, I didn't. I maybe wouldn't go so far as say I was scratching my head in terms of the changes that were made once Wan-Bissaka was sent off. I thought the first one was a substitute. The first big challenge for the manager, I can understand it because it happens quickly, the sending off. You're not expecting it. He's walking off the pitch and suddenly, what do you do? You've got to get it right back on the pitch. That's the first thing you've got to do. So Dallow's got to come on the pitch, so he's going to sacrifice. So that's your first big decision, and it's important because you get that wrong, you can't rectify it, and there's still the majority of the game to go. I was surprised he took Sancho off, I've got to be honest with you, because the first thing primarily when you go down to 10 men, I think for me in your head you're thinking, right, I need to keep legs on the pitch. You know, you're thinking your defensive mentality or your defensive setup from that point on to a point, don't get me wrong, but you're also thinking legs. I'm one man down, everybody's got to increase their workload now in terms of getting around the pitch, etc. And that's not just our possession, Jerry, in terms of having to run around a bit more, closing people down and a bit more defensive responsibility, but you've also got to be thinking about offering an attacking threat as well. And to do that, when you're playing with a man down, you're going to be operating from a reasonably low defensive block, being a man down. So you're going to be breaking out from deep defensive positions. And to do that effectively, you need pace. You need now pace in the team as well to complement that bit of defensive solidity to get yourself up the pitch.
Yeah.
And just to give you a respite, not necessarily to go and score goals, although that's what you're looking to do potentially on the counter-attack, but just to take the team up the pitch and get a bit of respite. So I was surprised Sancho wasn't having particularly the greatest of games, but he can give you that. He's got good legs, Sancho's a young lad, we know that. So that was the first one for me.
Could he not have gone to wing backs? Was it not a fairly obvious, like, you kind of have Fred drop into a central defensive role and then Sancho plays as a right wing back and Nick Shaw plays as a left wing back, and like, you don't trust Sancho at this stage of his career? You haven't seen enough of him? What's the...
Well, I don't know. I think for me, what's looming and what's obviously, which I think it is topical at the moment in terms of his reluctance to take, or has he got the bravery or the kahunas, I think, as you'd probably say, to make the big decision, maybe take Ronaldo off at that stage, or even Fernandez. Now, Fernandez isn't one you carry out possession. He's high energy and he does look to go and press. But for me, he's like, he hasn't got clear pictures in his head sometimes. When he goes to press, he goes alone. He gets passed around very easily. He kind of wastes his energy a lot of the time, Bruno. So he's kind of willing, but he's not quite smart at times in terms of how he and when he goes to press. So, yeah, in terms of the change of shape, he made a substitution at halftime for this. So he gets to halftime, Jed. He's made that one substitution, fair enough. He's got Dalot on the team. So he gets to halftime. Now he's had the 10 minutes before halftime and the whole of the halftime, have conversations with his coaches and get clear pictures in his head, right, how are we going to go about this second half? So for me, again, that was the opportunity, right? Now we get this defensive setup absolutely spot on. Now I couldn't say the way he set up the team. He went to a back five, he went to a narrow midfield three with Fred, Bruno to a right and Pogba to the left of him in kind of narrow defensive shield and Ronaldo up front. Now, I wouldn't have a huge problem with that. I wouldn't have done it personally, because when you play like that again and you're a man down, you really give up the sides of the pitch. You sacrifice all your width. You say, well, you got your wing backs, but a man down, you don't really have your wing backs. They get penned back and they get narrowed up, and now you have a midfield three operating within 25 yards of each other in that central area of the pitch, and they've really got to shift very quickly across the pitch, and it's almost impossible to do. So that's how you kind of give up the size to the opposition team. That's what I'm talking about. I'm always a little bit reluctant to do that, to be honest with you. People say get the extra defender on, get that back three in, and certainly it helps you in that central defensive area, but I don't think there was any need for that. Personally, for me, I'd rather keep two blocks of four on the pitch and that lone striker. So you keep that bit of width in those wide midfield areas, so you don't get exposed down the sides 2v1. And also you can break out from that. So if you have the likes of, if you still have Sancho on the pitch, you've brought on Greenwood or Jesse Lingard in those wide areas, those wide midfield areas, they can drop in and double up with the Manchester United fullbacks, but they can also break out and use that pace to get up in contact with Ronaldo if you're going to insist on keeping him on the pitch. So yeah, it wasn't so much he went to a back three, although I wouldn't have done it, but I looked at that midfield three. Now you're talking about Bruno and Pogba having the legs. Well, Pogba for me certainly doesn't have the legs. Pogba isn't the player that he was when we first broke into the Juventus team, playing left of a kind of diamond in midfield where he actually had the legs to get in and out and up and down the pitch. He's not. I don't think he can put that responsibility on him now. That's why I don't like to see him playing in wide areas, because you're carrying him now. You're carrying Pogba in the team in a wide area when you haven't got the ball. Now, this was different. He went left of a three, but there's still big defensive responsibility there to shift out into the full-back areas, etc. So, no, I was a bit worried when I saw Pogba and Bruno alongside Fred, who again, he's the one who you're really leaning on. You know, he's your defensive kind of linchpin at that moment, Fred. But I don't know how long Fred's been at the football club, but I still look at Fred now. I think he's not a natural defender. There's times in those games when he's played well, of course he has, but
okay, so he's not going to fix that. But in terms of Solskjaer, where what's your view at the moment on where Solskjaer is in his evolution as a manager? Is he getting better? Is there evidence that he's getting better?
You'd like to think so. You'd like to think so. The position that he's in, the experiences that he's had when he's been at the football club, he has to be getting better. But if he's not, that points to the fact that you're looking at somebody who really hasn't got a great understanding of the game and not really a lot of footballing intelligence. If you're not getting better operating at that level, the people he has around the players,
can
that
you
he's working
see?
It.
You say you'd like.
I think the team's getting better. That's a difficult one to. I think the team's certainly getting better in terms of recruitment, and I do like the players he's brought to the football club. But I don't know. It's difficult to say. There was a choice to be made in the summer in terms of where are we going to recruit? Where do we best need reinforcement?
Yeah.
So they haven't gone and spent in that area of the pitch that we're talking about, that central midfield area. Is that has Solskjaer gone to the club owners and said, look, I'm happy with what I've got in there. I'd rather we go and spend it centre half and higher up the pitch. If that's the case, then I would be concerned.
Yeah.
Because for me, that's
that way.
Yeah, exactly. So if he doesn't see that, that would be an early concern. Just in terms of the substitutions tactically at times during this time there, I think there's been game high profile games when it hasn't really worked. I suppose you could say that of every manager, but to be fair, the bigger managers when the big games come around, they kind of revel in it, and they generally get those decisions right in terms of how they set up their team, and also those big moments in the game when substitutes, not necessarily sending offs, but when substitutions need to be made to impact the game. I think we've seen that with Tuchel in a very kind of a small period, even when he's been at Chelsea. And I think the very top managers have that real tactical nous in terms of what's required there at any given moment during the game. And I'm not, yeah, and I think that's a fair point. I can't honestly say Solskjaer's kind of bowled me over in that respect. But I like the way the team's evolving. I think there's a team there that he can put on the pitch this season that can really challenge.
This season, it's his team, it's his vision, and if it hasn't been successful at the end of the season,
absolutely, I'd have no problem with that. Yeah, serious questions will be asked. Yeah.
All right, OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette, put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We're going to take a quick break. We're back talking about the Connacht rugby situation, and we're also going to be talking about the Tyrone success this year with one of their backroom team with Joe McMahon. That's coming up in the next few minutes. Stay tuned.
OTB AM.
7 minutes past eight this morning. Willa Callan is with us to bring us up to date on 24 hours of some developments, really, with regards to the women's inter-pros, where an Instagram video ended up showing where the Connacht women were getting changed before the Interpro at the weekend in Energy Park. Will, what happened yesterday that actually has moved the story on quite a bit?
Yeah, morning, lads. I guess the biggest development last evening was the IRFU statement, which came out last night, where they confirmed that an investigation is now underway into the circumstances which saw Connacht having to change beside those bins outside Energy Park at the weekend. They said, the IRFU, that they were appalled by the situation and that they found it entirely unacceptable where Connacht had to change beforehand. And they've now opened discussions with both Leinster and Connacht to talk about the circumstances around what happened at the weekend. That statement from the IRFU had followed a statement that was put out by the Connacht women's rugby team yesterday afternoon, where they had initially accepted Leinster and the IRFU's apology at the weekend, but they were looking for a formal investigation into the circumstances around it, particularly because it's been a little bit of back and forth around, you know, why it ended up that they were in the situation that they were getting tugged out there. And the suggestion over the last couple of days was the Connacht were a little bit earlier than expected in arriving to Dublin, so therefore this temporary area was put in place, and that's where they were told that they had to change ahead of the final round of the Interpro games. Connacht admitted in their statement yesterday that their performance against Ulster in the last round of fixtures on Saturday was affected by the circumstances of where they had to change before the game too. So as things stand now, Ger, an IRFU investigation is underway, and we had some of the male players speak about the situation, including the Irish captain Johnny Sexton yesterday as well.
Yeah, well, like, obviously those issues haven't been great, but you know, I think everyone that has been involved has apologised and said it won't happen again, and you got to take their word for it. And I think that the women's game has gone from strength to strength over the last while, but you know, hopefully moments like that won't, you know, shadow all the good stuff that's been going on. So, you know, I can't speak. I'm not involved in their camp, so I can't speak for everything that's going on. But I hope that they are. You know, I've got two young daughters myself that I hope will be involved in sport as they grow older, and I hope that they'll be looked after like I have been throughout my career.
That was the Ireland rugby captain Johnny Sexton speaking on the Hard Shoulder on News Talk yesterday afternoon. It was also the launch chair of the United Rugby Championship at the Aviva Stadium yesterday. One of the big announcements coming out of that Leinster will have 75% capacity for their opening fixture against the Bulls in the competition. That means 38,000 fans will be able to attend. They will have to be either vaccine certified that they've had it, or they'll have to show that they've recovered from COVID-19 in the last 6 months. But I asked Gary Ring, the returning Ireland and Leinster centre star, about the situation last weekend.
Yeah, I actually saw a video of it on Instagram, and like it's obviously pretty ridiculous, and it was clearly a massive mix. But I can't imagine it'd be a mistake that'll ever or shouldn't ever be made again. So, yeah, I don't really know the ins and outs of it other than it was a massive mistake and one that shouldn't have happened. But I've no doubt, as I said, it won't happen again.
See, the thing is that this wasn't the first time that it happened, right? We now know that it happened the week previous to this, that it wasn't just a one-off, that it was a two-off, that it had happened before that. And the other thing that happened this week was that the Connacht players have been told not to talk about this, and then they came out yesterday and issued the statement. So them issuing the statement is actually quite a significant moment in all this. It's actually, you know what, we're not just going to shut up. We're going to continue talking about this. So was there stronger support for them?
Yeah, look, we also heard from Paul Boyle from Connacht. Paul became a full Ireland international, the back row, this summer when he came on against the USA. And he said, Gerard, that the Connacht men's team had conversations about what happened at the weekend for their women's side.
We spoke about it ourselves in the change room that we wouldn't put up for it, and it's not good enough. I suppose from a bigger level, the apology has been made. Hopefully it won't happen again. Hopefully there's dressing rooms available and the COVID stuff goes away. But if a scenario like that was to happen again, hopefully the powers that be make the right decision and don't have the guys there.
Do you think that male rugby players need to support their female counterparts more?
Whenever there's a Connacht women's game on, we go and support them. But yeah, 100%. I think the game is growing. There's huge support behind it. I was watching the women's game against Spain there on Monday, and it was a really enjoyable game. The women's game is only getting bigger, so I think the more support it gets, the better.
It's a really interesting question there from Sinead Cassam, because if you think back to what happened with the Irish football team, Seamus Coleman certainly lent his support. It took a while for the men's football team to properly come out and support the women, but when they did it full-throated, and it led to a parity of esteem and equal pay. That's not quite, it seemed more like the lads were on message there, that, you know, it was a mistake, it's been apologised for. That seemed to be practised almost, that it was, maybe it's a coincidence that everybody said it was a mistake, it's been apologised for, and we're, you know, it's definitely not going to happen again. It seems, you know, maybe it's a coincidence that everybody had the same line, or maybe that was the official line coming out from the IRFU press people.
Yeah, look, it's very similar to the RFU line from the weekend. We have to remember that these players are employees of the RFU, where they're contracted through their provinces, so therefore they're likely to be on message. I think it's going to be intriguing when the players from the women's teams are able to speak a little bit more freely about this, because we're looking at amateur players across the board from last weekend, and that's one of the reasons that they found themselves in the circumstance that they did. Albeit there are so many other alternative areas where they could have been able to tog out around Energia Park and Donnybrook at the weekend, that you should never have ended up where they were. But these players, if they've been told not to speak, many of them don't have to be concerned by Irish contracts, because one of the main reasons that we're talking about Ireland being a little bit undercooked, Gerard, against Spain in the first of the World Cup qualifiers this week, is that the Irish players were all kept in camp and not released to play for the interprovincial series this year, like with the exception of a few former Irish players and, say, the likes of Anna Capeless, who was dropped from the squad and not picked for the World Cup qualifiers, playing for Munster in their success against Leinster last weekend. They can speak reasonably freely about it, but they've been told to keep stum at least until this investigation is completed. I wonder if in a few weeks' time you might get a Connacht player or two who will speak out entirely about what happened at the weekend. I mean, they've already kind of broken that emerta anyway by whoever created the video and released it at the weekend.
Yeah, look, I know what rugby players are, and they're going to say is that they represent the professionals in the game, but you would have thought that the interprovincials would be a recruitment ground for Rugby Players Ireland, and that they would be kind of out representing them in lieu of the fact that they're professionals, that they don't actually have a body organising them. And I'm on their website at the moment, and I see all the stuff that they've, they're teaching kindness, they're talking about helping to provide smart money habits program. There's highlights on their press releases. There's a statement about the retirement of Philip Brown. Reaction to the, but there's nothing about this.
Yeah, which is a little bit surprising, maybe not surprising at the same time, because you said they will say that they represent the players who are playing professionally within the country. But this year was meant to be a real shop window for the interprovincial series. It's, you know, improved in recent seasons, and notwithstanding the fact that the Irish players weren't available, which diluted maybe the quality of players that were on the pitch over the last few weekends for the series, it was being shown on TG Carr. It was getting a little bit more mainstream attention. It is a chance for players to impress further down the line and maybe to get themselves a contract to play for the 15s or 7s team in the future. And really, all of the focus has been on what happened last weekend and the unacceptable conditions that the players had. But I think a male voice on this from the Irish players carries a lot of weight. Like, if Johnny Sexton comes out and makes a very firm statement on what happened last weekend, that probably gets more coverage than a press release being put out by the Connacht women's team. So solidarity, it's amazing what a difference it can make if some of the male players come out and speak very strongly. I thought Paul Boyle did speak fairly well on the situation there, and it was interesting to see that the Connacht men's team actually sat down and had a conversation about it, that it wasn't just a case of them going, all right, last weekend was unacceptable, let's just move on. They were actually debating that in the dressing room as they were getting ready for the start of the new season.
Yeah, so again, just to go back to that, if the players don't feel confident enough, given that they are under contract to the IRFU, although they should feel confident enough to say this is wrong and our organisation needs to change this and we need to be agents of change in that, then the players' union should be coming out. The Rugby Players Ireland should be coming out. There's always been a suspicion that Rugby Players Ireland was a bit close to the IRFU, and the fact that their most recent statement is about the retirement of the chief executive of the IRFU as opposed to the appalling conditions that the women's teams were putting up with in the interprovincial would certainly give those people who believe that reason to be suspicious. So look, I don't know, you definitely would feel like the players' union needs to do more and the players need to do more about this, otherwise nothing changes.
Yeah, look, it's not like they'd be massively speaking out against their employers. I'm just looking at the statement here on otbsports.com from last night. And if the RFU is saying, we confirm that we're appalled by the situation, we've already commenced a review.
A week late, though, that's the only thing. They got shamed into that, really.
Yeah, look, it's four days late. They probably should have been much stronger. And I think one of the criticisms about the RFU at the weekend was that they put out a message that was effectively aligned with Leinster's initial statement about what happened last Saturday, as opposed to maybe going a little bit more strongly. The wording is definitely stronger from the RFU on Wednesday in the middle of the week than it was on Saturday and Sunday when this was a real live issue.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's partly why the Connacht women's team have looked to push the issue a bit more. I know they probably didn't want to stir the boat too much on Sunday when they said, look, we accept that mistakes were made and that there'll be learnings from this. Now they want something slightly more formal. I wonder if them going a bit stronger yesterday actually led from the reaction that we had. And I think as well, when it comes to the players, like, if Johnny Sexton or one key male player in the Irish team speaks out strongly about this, would he really be sanctioned by the RFU for it?
I don't think so.
Like, there might be a message, but he can speak freely.
Well, I don't know. Here's the thing. Like, you don't know. Actually, I don't know. Maybe the IRFU, maybe as an organisation, will bear a grudge for a long period of time. And if you want to be involved at a senior level when you're finished, you might not feel free to speak about it. Maybe it is the type of organisation. And that, I think, would be, you know, that would be in keeping with many Irish sports organisations where they bear grudges and you can't really rock the boat. So I don't know. It's a good question, and that's all the more reason why Rugby Players Ireland should have been leading the charge here, saying this is unacceptable. These are future members of ours, and even if they're not, this is not really how we treat people.
And look, that's a united front, and it's a difficult one as well, Ger, when it comes to these amateur players. If they're getting involved in these squads because they've aspirations of going further, they could well be blackballed if they're the ones who come out and speak out against us.
Okay, well, good stuff. Thanks a million for bringing us all that. Cheers.
Cheers, lads.
Will O'Callaghan stuff there. You can read it on the OTB Sports app, or, of course, you can read it on otbsports.com. It's nearly 20 minutes past 8 this morning. OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. I'm delighted to say we have Joe McMahon with us now. Joe, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning, Ger. How's things?
Very good. How has it been in the aftermath?
Yeah, it's been a great few days. I suppose the outpour of emotion you've seen in the immediate aftermath, and that was probably just pure emotion from the roller coaster of a year that it had been, with all the challenges that have been thrown at us, and to come out on top and experience winning All Ireland, and it was just great for the lads.
What's it like from your own perspective? What's the difference between winning one on the field of play and then being involved in the backroom team and plotting the course that you did have to plot this year? How do they compare? Is it possible even to compare them?
Yeah, well, funny, it's a question that I've been asked a number of times over the last number of days, and I suppose it's a difficult one, and the one constant is that we're Tyrone people and we want what's best for Tyrone, and to achieve that, both as a player, I'm in a privileged position, along with Pete Donnelly, Collie Holmes and Brian Duher there. And, I mean, you've seen it for yourself. The lads, we celebrated as if we were players also, and you could say on the pitch and also off the pitch there for a couple of days. And I think as a coach, you tend to, and you are involved as a whole group and thinking for everybody else. And as a player, you tend to just think about yourself and your own job. But I suppose it's a difficult one to compare and say one is better or one is less than the other. Much of it is the same. And in particular, when you talk about it and think about it as a coach, and you see moves coming together and what you've worked on off the or on the training pitch and coming to fruition on the actual day and on an Ireland final and up until that stage, it can be satisfying. But you know, in the midst of it all, you think to yourself, you've just won All Ireland, everything's rosy, but we certainly would have a lot of things to work on if we were to build on that.
Well, I mean, that's the best part about it, isn't it? The coaching journey never actually finishes because there's no such thing as perfection in sport, really. But it must have felt pretty close to it when the final whistle goes and some of those moves have come off. Can I ask you about your role, Joe? Because obviously, you know, we've known you as a deep thinker about the game and as somebody who could fulfil a multitude of different roles as a player. What's your job as a coach? What specifically do you look after? What are you charged with?
Yeah, well, we share the roles, and grateful to Brian and Fergal giving myself, Pete and Collie a free rein in terms of what our thoughts were, what our plans were. And with my own specific role, I was involved a lot with the skills end of things and refining the skills and then doing it under no pressure and then putting them in high pressure moments and exposing them in those areas. And I suppose that's a reflection and what how you want to be as a player and as a team. It's all right setting up nice fancy drills and they look good, but you want to see how they are in a pressurised moment, and we got a good opportunity for that because of the group of players we had, the availability we had for most of the season, and being able to work and bounce ideas off Holmesy and Pete Donnelly along with Fergal and Brian. And you know, I think building up to throughout the season, our main focus and the foundation of any performance is obviously the intensity and endeavour and everything that you want to give with your hard work, but your skills. It's all right having a game plan, that's one thing, but being able to execute it at a high level with the skills is very important, and that's something we focused on in particular.
When you say skills, is that all aspects? Like, is that does that include shooting? Is it hand passing off your weak hand? Is it as basic and fundamental as that to try and put the stress on the players so they realise that actually they do need to go and do a little bit of work in their own time on one specific aspect of it? Or is it actually more teamwork? What are you talking about?
Yeah, so in particular with your skills, just your basic fundamentals, as simple as your hand pass, your catching, your pickup, and then just your kick passing, solo and shooting, all of those things. And it's piecing it together that you can do it under no pressure and then being able to execute under high pressure. And it was never a case of, you know, that's saying that one thing is saying that's not good enough, that's fair enough, but why is it not good enough? And it's highlighting what maybe areas that fellas need to work on the training field and away on their own as well. And as much as you can, and I feel myself and personally, when you're going to a gym session, if you're prepared to put as much time in the gym, you should be prepared to put as much time into your skills, because those are things that you can do in your own time, and then when you bring it to the training field, it'll further press on everything that you're trying to do as a group. And I suppose you could see that to an extent, but there's still plenty to work on.
It seems that a lot of the country woke up to the quality and the basic skill sets of club football in Tyrone last year when club matches were actually televised, that there's a deep reservoir of very talented, skillful footballers. So the raw materials that you have to work with, they're ingrained. Was that always the case, Joe? Or is that kind of an explosion post your team in the noughties that actually the dividend from your group then going back to the clubs and coaching has actually led to this scenario where you do have a lot of very talented players that you have to work with?
Yeah, well, that is a good observation, and the exposure that the club football got in recent years, you got to see that, and a lot of people got to see that, and that's credit to the work that has gone on within the clubs, the high quality coaching happening throughout. I've seen it in my own club as well, Omas and Dendes, and the time and an effort that it takes to get to that level. And I suppose I'm involved at the very early age of my own club at the Gaelic Start. So you're talking in around 4-year-olds to 6-year-olds at that stage. And I think there has been a lot of work done throughout Tyrone clubs in the last number of years. And it's really honing in on the skills and then the game sense along with that. And you can see that a lot of the lads that I've worked with this year, some of them have played with, some of them have watched from an underage, and they always had that skill level. And you can look back to maybe those players looking at their idols from the noughties, the likes of Callaghan, McGuigan, Muggsy. Those lads, when they look at those players and want to emulate and see how they play the game and watch how they play the game, maybe it might think, this is what I need to do. And I've been very lucky in terms of coming in at the level that I have at this with the Tyrone team. The high skill level is there, but it's really just continually pressing them, and they've put in a serious amount of work and effort, and it's paid off, thankfully.
The game smarts is the other thing you talk about there, and that team in the noughties, it had the McMahons and it had McGinley, and it didn't just have the absolute ballers like McGuigan and Canavan that you're talking about, but it definitely had players, Philip Jordan, who understood my role is to do a specific thing today, and if I do that role then we're going to be in the best position to win. In some ways it's the sublimation of ego, and I don't know how a manager manages to get that perfectly correct, but your team, this team that has just won, seems not to have too much ego in it at all, in the way that, like, you had a former candidate for Footballer of the Year on the bench, coming off the bench and scoring and scoring and scoring and scoring, and still happy to come off the bench and still, like, you know, in the perfect position to score essentially the match winning goal that broke Mayo's hearts. How does that happen? Where does that come from?
I suppose any thrown person, or and in particular with reference to the players, I mean, they want to win, and it's almost a monkey off these lads' back, because maybe the noughties was thrown at them from the outside in, and these lads wanted to make a name for themselves as a group, and the time, the effort, the dedication, and the work that had gone on previous to this management group come in had certainly set us on our way to getting the best out of these lads. And the respect that Brian Duher, an All-Ireland winning captain, and Fergal Logan, who represented Tyrone and is a major presence and very highly thought of by the lads, everything that they brought, the environment that they created, their communication with the players, and it was just highlighting this is we as a group are not far away. And lads came in and they knew their roles from early on, and we got that through our training sessions. We played a lot of football. Lads got set in their ways in the in-house games that we played, and that was probably something that didn't happen in the past for a variety of reasons, and there was a change of positions here, there and everywhere, but lads maybe were set in their ways with the position, got to know their position, got coached in that position, and had a good understanding of what the role was in the team, and whether that was a starting role or a playing role when you were coming into the game, and how you were going to influence the game. And there was never any egos with these lads, having played with them, having watched them, and it was just nurturing all their talents and piecing it together and getting the best out of them. And there was no question in their hunger, their desire, their work rate, none of that. It was just the fine margins. It was taking their opportunities when they came in the game. It was being able to execute a skill, as we alluded to earlier, in high pressure moments. And I think when you have a leader like Paul de Campsie, and been able to lead by example, it was never much in how he said it, it's what he did and how he went about his business. The lads fed off that, and I mean, it was amazing to see him and his homecoming in Kilkenny.
It helps that all of your defenders can kick the ball sweetly with the outside of the right foot over the black spot from about 40, 45 metres. That's like a pretty good skill to have.
It's not bad now. Paddy done it a couple of times, and he certainly has that quality there. And that's the modern day Gaelic footballer, I suppose. You're not stuck to one position, and it's having that belief that the likes of Michael McKiernan, Ronan McNamee, Paddy Hamsey, you've seen it in the semi final, all going to go up and get a point. And I suppose if you look at it, I mean, they're all major athletes. You've seen their ability to get up and down the field, but to do that is one thing. To get up there, kick the points maybe at the end of a long run, then get themselves back into position, it's exhausting. But they were well prepped and everything that they've done, and it's a few fires for opposition teams to put out if you know that scores are coming from everywhere. And I suppose you could look back and thank Racy McManaman for that.
When you talk about the players, it sounds, so we've talked about the skills that they have, and we've talked about the personalities that they have, and then the coaching that they have. Who has the responsibility for actually deciding what the game plan is going to be for the semi-final and final? Like, how does that evolve from the conversations with the coaches and the management and the players?
Well, I suppose it's a bit of an open shop, really, in terms of when we talk and we reflect on a training session or we're planning for a training session. We look at maybe areas that we need to focus on. And with the short league that we had, with only three games, really, and there was a lot of reflection and a lot of work done with video and looking at areas that we could improve upon and really building on each session. I suppose the time and effort that was put in with our planning, with our thought process, and we felt that maybe kickouts was an area that we wanted to look at. And in terms of a game plan as a whole, it was left open. Everybody had their thoughts, their ideas, and it was just piecing that together and then going out and putting it in the training field and trying to execute it in preparation for our opposition teams. And there's certainly been a lot of elements of luck as you went through the season. You could look at some of the chances Kerry maybe had against us, Monaghan in the Ulster final as well, Donegal, the penalty, big turning point in the game, and the final as well. Maybe you could look at stages where Mayo could have got the scores, but whilst that element of luck is there behind it all, we had opportunities ourselves and maybe didn't take it. And I think the game plan as a whole, we just wanted to focus on and develop the team with areas like the kickouts, like the press, and just behind it all, a high work rate, and that's what we got out of the lads.
The Kerry Lee game, when the story of this comes to be written, is going to end up being the road to Damascus, St Paul's conversion, as big a moment in the whole year. And maybe we're retrospectively investing too much in that one moment. But what do you think changed in the aftermath of that? And I think a couple of the lads were doing interviews with the BBC podcast over the last while, and they were just saying that it was a massive wake-up call, tried something new that day. I think no sweepers at all that day. And it was like, I need to rethink this a little bit.
Yeah, well, you really... you could certainly look at it as a turning point in the season, but I think that we tried something, we worked on maybe going more man to man and asking more of our players individually, maybe coming off the back of setting up defensively as a whole. We felt that we had the quality there that to go man to man, and it was something that, you know, left us with our eyes open wide, that we felt maybe we need to work on particular areas of our game. And a lot of mistakes had a lot to do with the scoreline that day. And any time you go down to Kerry, and I've experienced it unfortunately myself, it's always a tough place to go, and they will certainly ask a lot of questions of you. We hadn't had much time together leading up to that game, bar the few National League games, and we had the draw against Monaghan, and we were beat by Donegal, and we'd beaten Armagh. So, I mean, in terms of prep, we might have taken our eye off the ball and felt that, you know, we are better than we were. And the big thing after that game was we did have a bit of time. Our sights were set in Cavan, which was a good game to get in terms of they were the Ulster champions, had refocused the minds, and we knew that it was going to take a lot of time and effort to build ourselves. And we never looked beyond Cavan, we never looked beyond Donegal because of the route we travelled. It was a game at a time, but there were many turning points beyond that. Lads stepped up in different moments of the season, and you really saw the confidence beginning to grow through the group. But it was certainly the platform to a good season. And I've heard in the aftermath that many people threw on a few pounds and thrown at good odds after beating Pickery. But in the aftermath, it certainly didn't feel that way, and it was definitely a brave bet.
Yeah, I'm sure. And sometimes that old cliche about learning more about yourselves in defeat is actually true, and you need those dressing down to go back to first principles. Can I ask you, you mentioned Omas and Endes there. Conor Myler's performances this year and just his general maturity, he's kind of emerged now almost since the game as a leader publicly that, you know, he's willing to talk about stuff that we should all be willing to talk about, and that's really important. But such a composed young man and also like endless gifted, it seems, a big deep thinker of the match. I've been reading his LinkedIn reviews of the Michael Jordan documentary. You know, this is a guy who's studying leadership at PhD level. So what's he like to have in the dressing room?
Yeah, well, I've worked with Conor from a very young age. I've seen him grow, seen him to develop, and credit to his family and Shawnee and Paula, his mother and father, and the time and effort that they've put in terms of his development. And Conor would say himself, and has said himself publicly at a young age and through his underage career, he was never the standout player, but he always felt that if he worked hard enough, he would get to the level that needed to be a county player and a senior club footballer, and he's proved that. And in terms of the man himself, he's very driven, as you've seen and heard, and you've seen that in his performances. He shows great leadership with his performances, and the lads feed off his work rate, they feed off his energy in terms of what he can give, how he communicates it to the lads, how he sees the game, how he can impact the game individually and the fellas around him. And I feel that Conor was absolutely delighted. He was one of the lads and many of the lads that had embraced after the game, but to see the journey that he's travelled, he has a big future ahead of him currently on the pitch and also off the pitch, and it was just absolutely delighted for my own club man to achieve the All-Ireland glory.
One of the things that we had on Sheehan up last week in the build-up to the match, just kind of touring around chatting to people, and he came back and said he thought it was a fact, but almost everybody, if not everybody involved in the team, is actually from Tyrone, which is kind of unusual in an inter-county setup. Is that correct? Is it an accident? Was it on purpose? Was it by design?
I think I'm not too sure what the thoughts were around it or why it was that, but I think generally it was people maybe that are like-minded and are wanting the same thing and were prepared to give it. And, you know, if you look at the backroom team of Paul, Stevie Rice, are both lads that have represented Tyrone as well. And I think that everybody that has a like-mindedness and are wanting the same thing are heading in one direction. It's certainly something that will lead us there.
It's a unified purpose, a unified understanding of what the beliefs are and what the values are and what everybody stands for, I guess.
It definitely is, and I think whilst everybody is wanting the same thing, there was certainly times where things were questioned and you felt that maybe you wanted it done this way or another way. And when it come to team selection, maybe there are a few thoughts and ideas around other players and other positions. And it's a healthy conversation to have, because I suppose, as the saying goes, you don't get harmony with everyone singing the same note. And I think there were definitely times in the year where questions were asked and raised and brought forward. And it's good to have that. And the beauty of the setup that Fergal and Brian had created was everybody had an input, and essentially they had the final decision. And thankfully, it paid off as a whole.
Yeah, no, it definitely did. Joe, it's great, always great to talk to you. Thanks a million for making the time for us this morning. Cheers. Congratulations.
Good man. Thank you.
Said Joe McMahon there, part of the backroom team for Tyrone. Not a situation that happens in many sports where you have multiple managers, Kenny.
Yeah, no, it was really interesting. But I see a lot of parallels. You hear some of the top in team sport, I'm talking about kind of, you know, top coaches talking. This is the kind of template, the management team, the management structure, the individual responsibilities of those individual coaches, take it onto the training pitch, work with the players, the individual groups, the individual players themselves, and kind of roll it out over a period of time, be consistent, keep preaching the same messages, and the improvement will come. So yeah, it was really interesting to listen to that, but it all made sense. I've kind of heard it before. We're going to have heard it before, because that's what happens at top level team sport, and when it's implemented correctly, you kind of
very powerful.
You reap the rewards.
Yeah. Okay. It is 8:41 this morning. John Duggan is with us. John, good morning to you.
Ger and Kenny, how are we doing?
What's going on?
Well, we've got Liverpool and AC Milan playing a great game of football last night. It was really enjoyable to watch. I hope people don't take it for granted. It seems that those days of empty stadiums are a long time ago, but they're not. They weren't 100 years ago, they're only recently. So it was just amazing to see a full Anfield at a European night, and the match that we saw and the 3-2 win. And I thought Liverpool were brilliant. That deflected goal that gave them the lead, then Salah missing the penalty, then Milan just capitalising on just a few minutes of maybe a lapse of concentration in the Liverpool defence to score those two goals. But the resilience that they showed after half time, Salah equalising and then Jordan Henderson getting the winner. So 3-2 win. The other game in that group, Atletico Madrid and Porto, was a goalless draw. We had Manchester City scoring six goals, six different players. Jack Grealish probably the pick of them, a 6-3 win over Leipzig as they're off to a good start. Lionel Messi, the Galacticos of Paris Saint-Germain, were held to a 1-1 draw by Club Brugge. So that was what's happened in the Champions League last night. Loads of matches this evening in Europe as well. We had Celtic against Real Betis. They've gone to Spain without a few of their players, Callum McGregor and Lila Abada. Rangers are taking on Lyon at Ibrox. We've got Leicester against Napoli, and Spurs in this Conference League against Rennes. And you also have Chris Hughton probably on the brink of the sack now after Nottingham Forest lost again 2-0 against Middlesbrough. Hasn't really worked out for him at the City Ground. But it's one of these clubs where it hasn't really worked out for many managers back to the Frank Clark days, really, I would suppose, you're saying. And the other, I suppose, sporting news at the moment, so we got James Sugru playing in the Dutch Open. He started well. He was 2 under par a short time ago. We've got six Irish players in that. There's a Fortinet Championship on the PGA Tour. And the IRFU saying that it's appalled at what transpired at Energia Park in Donnybrook last weekend. So we Connacht and Ulster women's squads having to change in a derelict area beside waste bins. The video doing the rounds we've seen, if you haven't seen it, it's pretty shocking. Amateur players have got to comply with COVID restrictions, but the IRFU have launched a full review into the unacceptable situation. So it's their second statement, and they came out with another statement after Connacht requested a review into the situation yesterday. The Connacht players breaking ranks, as it were. So just because a sport is amateur, you can't have substandard treatment.
No, it doesn't make any sense that. And a second statement means you didn't get the first statement right. So,
well, the reporting in the Irish Times wasn't good the other day, where players were being asked not to comment. Also, this year has been the year of the woman in sport. When you think about it, Rachel Blackmore won six races at Cheltenham against her male counterparts and won the Aintree Grand National. Leona Maguire is the top point scorer at the Solheim Cup. Meath go from winning an intermediate to a senior. Kelly Harrington wins an Olympic gold. Ellen Keane wins a Paralympic gold. Kelly George Dunleavy and Eve McChrystal win a Paralympic gold. This is the year of the woman. And also, we have a situation where you can't have PR disasters as you had in the past. We had it with the soccer team changing their tracksuits and toilets. We had it with last year, the complete farce about a ladies football semi-final being moved to Croke Park with how much notice? No notice. And then you had issues around expenses. You can't have these PR disasters anymore. If we're putting the spotlight on the front page of the Irish Times a couple of weeks ago, which was absolutely fantastic about really the dominant sporting stories, you can't have these situations.
No, you just think that in terms of how the PR has been handled for this one, they just haven't managed it. And again, I would just wonder, where are the rugby players' union in all this? They have the handy excuse of it not being professional, but I don't think that's good enough either. So, John, I do want to ask you a couple of other things before you mentioned Chris Hughton there. So I just want to ask Kenny about this. It's a difficult situation for Chris Hughton, but he's being linked with the Republic of Ireland manager's job as well. So there's a few dominoes to fall at the moment, Kenny.
I haven't even thought about it, to be honest with you, Jared. Yeah, now I can probably see the maybe at a stretch, see the connection, but no, I wouldn't be thinking in that direction personally. Don't really feel as if there's an appetite. I might be wrong, not particularly close to in terms of the FAI, but don't sense any real appetite for a change at the top. And I think if we can have a reasonable finish to the qualifying campaign, which we're hopeful of, I don't anticipate any change going forward in terms of Stephen Kenny's position. So, yeah, I think that's very much a long shot in terms of what you're talking.
Let's assume that there's reasonable performances in the final three games, that a European campaign would be a fair outcome for the current Ireland management setup, that they should be given the opportunity to qualify for the Euros.
I think that's you're asking me what will happen. I think that's what will happen. And like I said, I'm not particularly close to anybody. I haven't heard anything in particular, but I just sense as if there's very little appetite, yeah, to kind of show Steve and the backroom staff the door and kind of start the whole process again. And you'd have to say kind of the performances in Portugal and to an extent against Serbia, small indicators there, you know, that progression is happening. It's not perfection, absolutely not, and it needs to get better. Question is, do you trust Steven and the staff with the responsibility to do that? So as I said, yeah, that's my gut feeling at the moment. Things can change very quickly, as we know. Still some key games to play in the qualifying campaign, but that's my kind of gut feeling. I wouldn't be looking sideways and looking at other managers out there, Chris Hughton or any other managers, and potentially there's a quick fix here, or you know, there's an obvious, you know, change in the guard in the foreseeable future. I don't really get a sense that I'm not really feeling it.
Okay, we don't really need any more quick fixes, do we? As a country, we need.
Yeah,
some
no, maybe not quick.
Fixes.
No, maybe not. Chosen the wrong words there, but maybe a change in the change in the management. Team, you know, nobody's indispensable. Like, I'm not one of these people. I heard a couple initially when Stephen got the job saying, well, we've got to commit for 4, 6, 8 years here. I heard people say, and regardless of results, regardless of performance, we've got to commit to this kind of new plan. I wouldn't be buying into that either, to be honest with you. But
the middle ground is maybe the Euros. Let's see how the Euros goes.
Do you feel, Kenny, we need to get results in Luxembourg and Azerbaijan?
No, I never know. I don't buy into like games specifically, you know. I do think generally it's the overall picture, and I think at the end of the qualifying campaign, when that comes, John, in November, that's the time and just look back on the whole campaign and every aspect of the campaign, and then kind of make a judgment call then. I'm sure there'll be conversations with Stephen and the backroom staff, but I think a certain amount of it is still dependent in terms of what we see between now and November. I wouldn't be totally dismissing that, because there needs to be kind of progression. We can't see a massive dip drop.
No,
between now and then. That's indicators potentially that, well, then maybe a change is required. But just when you're kind of your chin's hitting the floor and that bit of despondency is creeping, you just see something, don't you, in terms of performance, whether that's kind of individually or, you know, something, the performance collectively, you know, a passage of play or,
yeah,
you know, a bit of cohesion to the play, John, in our possession, and you're thinking, right, there's something coming together here. I guess
you score goals, okay? You can't score goals. That's the issue.
No, I wouldn't even. Yeah, of course you want to score as many goals as you can, but of course you get that kind of cohesion that I'm talking about. You get that right, you know, you score more goals and you can see less goals, and that's the kind of, so drives every football manager. That's what drives, you know, I suppose that's what Joe McMahon was talking about to a large degree there as well. It's got to be, it's every aspect of the game that you got to get right. That's a challenge for the management team, for Stephen and his coaches there. And there's been a small change there as well, hasn't there, James? A new coach coming in from Chelsea, short period of time. Again, you think, you know, just give a little bit of time. That's a bet in as well, his relationship with the other coaches, and potentially that might come to fruition kind of going forward. But yeah, kind of, you know, I'm not saying things that aren't there, like, you know what I mean? But I must admit, the last couple of games, just in terms of team shape and potentially like a team, I'm seeing now 8-9 players now and maybe a structure on the pitch where I'm thinking, yeah, I can see that going forward. There's a balance to the team. There's individual players there who I'm giving me kind of confidence, who are put together in the right team shape and put the right partnerships on the pitch. Potentially there's a future there.
The graphic keeps coming up about the games, how number of games it is since we've had a win, and there's no asterisk beside it going half the team was missing because of COVID, or this was a new manager who actually had no time to build any rapport with the players, who wasn't allowed to sit in the same room as his team to give team talks for any longer than 15 minutes, or who had to social distance. I think it was very difficult circumstances, a new inexperienced manager, and finally he had in the summer camp with the players where they actually got to hang out and talk, and these are my beliefs, this is what I'm trying to do. So I'm saying these next three games, it's fair to make some judgment. We need to actually play well in those three games and continue to show signs. And my view is that he needs to be given at least the start of the European campaign, where we're going to give you this full campaign, but if it goes tits up early, tough luck. Like, that's a fair enough, as opposed to get him out now, get somebody in for the Euros. It's like, that makes no sense.
I think it's fair. Sorry, John, go ahead.
Well, it doesn't make sense if Jonathan Hill has come out in the last week and says we've got a strategic plan of 4 years to get Ireland to the World Cup in the United States and have this link with the diaspora. If you've got a strategic plan as an organisation, you need a strategic manager. It's just silence.
I'm not quite sure what a strategic manager means, to be honest with you. But
well, you're giving somebody time to build for the future. That it's not just constantly bringing in managers and quick fixes.
Or just how much time, John? I suppose that's the question. I agree to some extent in terms of managers need time. Every situation is different. When you walk into a football club, you walk into a football club with an experienced, battle-hardened group of players who are together, understand their roles. You don't actually need a huge amount of time in that kind of situation. You walk into a dressing room that's it's a little bit scattered. There's a need to kind of integrate younger players, inexperienced players into squad. That's different. That's a different challenge. That can take a little bit more time. So I think people understand that. But it's not a limited amount of time. That's clear as well. And I'm sure Stephen will understand that. But as Jerry says there, I think it's fair to say that bit of progression, those kind of green shoots that we've seen, we've got to see more of them, I think, over the next 2 months. I think there's a big drop off, John, in the next kind of four games. I think it's harder to make that argument that you've just kind of made. You can't just dismiss the quality of those performances. Oh, look, let's not concentrate on those. They don't matter because we've got a strategic plan here. That's not good enough either. So I think it's got to be a little bit of both. As long as we see that kind of bit of progression, just see elements to the performances over the next couple of days that we saw against Portugal and Serbia, and we see more of that, then I think there's grounds for, well, let's stick with it. We're actually heading somewhere here. I can see something coming together. Yeah, let's stick with where we're going. So I think that's fair.
All right. John, virtual insanity this week?
Yeah, well, Shane Lowry kind of did us last week. I think, I don't know whether he knew he was in the Ryder Cup team or not, but it all fell apart on the Sunday. But I remember a year ago, I watched the Safeway Open, as it was called, wall to wall, because it was the first real tournament of the new PGA Tour season, and is the first tournament of the PGA Tour season for 2021-2022. So I do have my mind, it's in the memory bank pretty vividly. From last year, I remember I put Doc Redman up last year and he finished with a 62 to finish in a tie for third. So I put him up again as the headline tip, Doc Redman, at 125-1. And I really do feel there's a lot of talk about this tournament that players, they're looking at recent form, they're looking at strokes gained, all this kind of thing. Players have had a break, they're coming back. And Doc Redman is a player at 23 years of age, former US amateur champion, that nearly won twice in the PGA Tour last season. If he channels some good memories from last season, I think he's got an each-way chance at a big price. The other ones I went for, Will Zalatoris, still hasn't won on the PGA Tour. Amazingly, Rookie of the Year, Masters runner-up, he's 22-1 each way. Doug Ginn, like Zalatoris and Redmond, was in the Walker Cup team of 2017 that trounced Great Britain and Ireland. Some of the other players like Colin Morikawa and Scotty Scheffler are playing in the Ryder Cup next week. So Doug Gim is a very good tee to green player, which you need around the Silverado course. So I've gone for him at 55-1. And then a couple of others, Harry Higgs, who was second in the tournament last year at 80-1. And Nick Hardy, a graduate for the Corn Ferry Tour, one of the best ball strikers, which you need again at this track this week, on the Corn Ferry Tour. Nick Hardy was 250-1. These are all on the OTB Sports app and otbsports.com. Nick Hardy, Harry Higgs, Doug Gim, and we have Doc Redman as the headline tip and Will Zalatoris. So I'm feeling quite confident this week, because if you don't feel confident about it, you're going to drive yourself demented, and you will be insane virtually and in reality.
Sorry, John. Joe, one last thing. John, would you have taken Justin Rose? One of your
I would have taken Justin Rose
instead of
Poulter.
Right.
I think Poulter, it was 9 years ago. And I think Justin Rose is playing better golf at the moment. And Justin Rose is also...
Garcia playing better golf than Poulter at the moment?
Can't not take Garcia because they had the fight. Is that it?
Well, also, you've got to think of partnerships. John Rahm and Garcia, you think as two Spaniards. You think of Shane Lowry and Rory McIlroy. So I'd be thinking a lot of English players in the team. And I'm thinking of partnerships. I think Rose is playing better golf than Poulter. I think Garcia is still a very good driver of the golf ball, so he will work very well in the foursomes. And you also can't argue with the fact, Kenny and Jared, that he's the leading all-time point scorer for Europe in the Ryder Cup. We need a Larry in there, but I would have picked Rose over Poulter. I actually watched the Miracle of Medina video within the last few days, and Rose was just as good as Poulter at clutching that win over Phil Mickelson in the singles.
One giant putt?
Yeah, that's right. When he just does this, which I probably should do when I have a virtual insanity winner in here, whenever that'll be, probably in the next 3 years.
No, this week.
This week. So Justin Rose is an Olympic champion and he's a major champion. Ian Poulter's neither. Sorry, Ian, if you're watching OTB AM.
Yeah, who would you have brought?
I'd agree with John of taking Rose, but Garcia's
Garcia's expense.
I don't think Rahm
needs
Garcia, needs anybody with him. He's that good. And I think the record one, you can only keep playing that tune for so long. His record in Ryder Cup, you get to a certain age and your form dictates. They're the biggest key factors in terms of whether you deserve a place. Is that what's Poulter's record like? I mean,
oh, sensational.
It's got to be. There's an argument where he's got it if you're talking purely on.
But can Poulter just turn up? I'm not so sure if Poulter can just turn up and channel this otherworldly Tiger
John,
Woods.
I've been watching. You watch more PGA golf than me. Anytime last year or so, put on the PGA, Poulter's around it.
He's played well on the PGA Tour, but a miscut at Wentworth didn't.
He's been playing well, one miscut, and that's the strength.
No, but that was the pressure tournament when they double points, and Rose really delivered in that tournament.
Oh, you can't say Poulter hasn't delivered under pressure. God, dear, oh dear, surely you're not making that argument. We can't trust Poulter under pressure.
Let's see how Poulter gets on against Luxembourg and Azerbaijan, that's all I can say.
Are there many times where a major winner hasn't made the team in the year that he's won the major?
I think it has happened, but off the top of my head, I'm struggling to see when it was or who it was.
So, Mickelson, there was never any...
Yeah. The Mickelson thing was a complete
fluke.
It was a fluke. It was. He was a 300-1 shot. It was one of those lightning in the bottle.
Leave off, John. You
it was
can't
a lightning
say
in
that.
The bottle.
Well, and
to be honest, Mickelson was not a good. Has not been a good Ryder Cup player.
Okay, so
Philip Rice was Mickelson.
That's true.
I think America have enough talent in there.
Who's going to win it, John?
Europe, based on what Brooks Koepka said yesterday.
Would you have Koepka in the team? I saw people calling for him to...
I wouldn't.
Paul Azinger was saying, give up your place.
I wouldn't have him in the team, or Patrick Reed in the team.
Did you see what Koepka was saying? It was like, he doesn't really enjoy it. It's kind of a bit of a pain in the ass, basically.
They want me to go to meetings. I
like to go, I need to snooze. Normally I have a nap.
Well, you know all about issues and football
squads. But there was logic to what he was saying. You're obviously... riding him there, live and making fun of him, but it kind of made perfect sense in what he was saying. But you've just got to kind of override that.
It's one week of the year. You don't have to be the killer for the 1 week of the year when you're representing your country. But that's the thing. I don't think the Americans feel they're representing their country as much as the Europeans do, even though Europe's not a country anymore.
Yeah, I think they can perform even in that kind of mindset, that kind of individual, you know, it's about me, how boom, 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 boom. I think if you tried to introduce that into the European dress, it just wouldn't happen for a lot of different reasons. Culturally, we just can't function that way. We kind of thrive in the other environment, that kind of team atmosphere. I think the Americans are, a lot of those American lads are perfectly fine with that kind of mindset that Kepa is talking about there. Yeah. You know what I mean? I know functionally, practically,
yeah, I get that.
The organisation of the day and all that type of thing, but I think that's, I don't think that's a really, I think they can win with that mindset, even with that mindset.
Well, John, I think they can blow you out with that mindset, but I'm not sure they can win in a close game when the opposition team actually behaves and functions like a team.
Yeah, which they didn't do in 1999 at Brookline. Yeah. Look, they're proud of the Americans, obviously. I'm being a little bit facetious, but I could never see the Americans bringing out a video like the Miracle in Medina and all them talking about it for an hour and a half. It just, it's not within their, you know, culture of the Ryder Cup. Maybe because they were winning for three decades and has only got, and I think with the Americans, once they started losing it heavily, they kind of got apathetic about it in 02, 04 and 06, and they need to feel that they're, that it's a real close rivalry for them to get engaged with it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. If you want to get in touch this morning and give us your views on that, you can get us, of course, in the YouTube stream. Good stuff, John. Thanks very much for that. We are going to be talking football, what the atmosphere was like at Liverpool in just a moment, and then we'll bring you some of the latest football pod with Paddy and Andy. But OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors.
It basically goes two All-Ireland down in one season. That's basically what's happened. It's only 9 months since we lost the last one.
Only Mayo could lose two All-Irelands in one.
That's going to be cool.
That's all over Twitter tomorrow.
But yeah, so like, it's a very difficult one. The huge problem is you have a style of play, and we're talking 3 weeks ago, yes, me and Paddy are analysing, and Paddy's on about not scoring enough. And in fairness, I give Paddy credit because he called a Dublin performance to a T, but that Dublin didn't do their end of your bargain, Paddy. That
lads, let me down with that.
You called it to a T, and now it's like we're now questioning, do they need to kick the ball more? Do they need to do this more? What did they do? And there's a blueprint now set out by Tyrone to how to go and beat a Mayo and how to go and beat a Kerry. So, do you have to change? Lee Keegan isn't getting any younger, lads. He was, again, outstanding the last day. He did stuff in the last two games where I probably thought that had probably gone for me. But he resurrected himself again. And to do that, and like Lee, like his personal life, his little girl, as he's seen, they've another baby on the way. So that's huge in your own personal life. And then you have all the other fellas with kids. I'm telling you, lads, it's hard to know. It's hard to know what is going to happen in the next 3 months. I don't know. I genuinely don't know. I can't put my finger on it. James is a huge job. He's a huge job in his hands. But I don't have the answer. I honestly don't. And I don't even know what to say to you, Tommy, to give you that.
I think, to be honest, Tommy, it's the same. I think every county, and James Horne is going to be no different, he's going to be looking to find, how can I get two or three new players in here? Like I said, there might be another couple of guys gone from the back end squad. Like I said, we have praised James Horne for the role that Mayo essentially in transition have made it back-to-back All-Ireland finals. Now, they haven't got over the line, but there's a lot of counties that would happily swap for that type of record when your team is in, you know, for want of a better word, transition, and turning over some of their most iconic players that they've ever had. So what he's looking to do going away now, he's looking to try and find a couple of new players. He's the same, I would say, that every team that I think Desi Farrell is going to be looking for with Dublin, whoever's in charge of Kerry, whoever's in charge of Cork, Patrick Joyce with Galway, you're looking to evolve your game and get a little bit better, because ultimately all of those teams are looking, I know Dublin, I know Kerry, even though Mayo are in transition, they're all going to be disappointed with how this season ended out. So if I'm the coach, how can I get two or three new guys? Mayo, no doubt, are looking for, can we get another forward in there? Killian O'Connor will be back next year, please God. I think they want to find a role, a definitive role for Aidan O'Shea. If he's still a kind of a massive player for them, and they're not getting the best out of him in big games. Now, I think that's Jewel. I think that's Aidan himself will need to look at that. And I'm sure James Horner as a coach will need to look at that. But that's they'll be disappointed, but they've been here before. They need to find a couple of new players. Can we evolve our game plan to start? Yeah. Okay, we're really, really good at running the ball. Can we start in our first three or four National League games next year? They're back up in the Division One. Can we start getting a game plan where we can start troubling teams in a way more direct fashion and add that strength to our ball? But there's loads of counties. Like say, your Galways, your Dublins, your Kerrys, we're all looking to get. It's an interesting National League next year. It's back to back to normal. And there's teams that will definitely feel they've underperformed this summer and they're going to be looking to put things right next spring.
Paddy, Darren McCurry won man the match, and afterwards he was asked a question, and when I heard the quotes, I wrote it down that I wanted to ask you this. McCurry said, when I left the panel in 2018, I just had to get myself back to my best, back to Dazzler. And I wonder, and it's kind of to do with the winter question I asked Andy there, but what can Mayo do? And on an individual level, what can the players do? When you were told in 2011 that you were being dropped from the Dublin panel, how did you, and I presume it was a long process and it may have taken a while, but how did you move on from that and come back a better player?
It's a hard thing, and Darren McCurry is obviously a massive example of someone getting to the very top of the game, but lots of players have been dropped off county teams and our club teams, and it doesn't work out as much. You might just turn around and say, particularly for older guys later on in their careers, they might say, you know what, maybe this isn't for me, and they go away, and that's a fine, that's a totally personal decision. They say, I'm not gonna do the whatever I'm being asked to do by the coaches. But there are cases where guys turn around and say, I have belief in my ability. I know I'm a good player. I know I'm good enough to play at this level, because you start doubting everything, Tom. You're doubting, geez, the coaches are right. It's never personal. The coaches, it was Pat for me. I know it was Mickey Hart for Darren McCurry. It's never personal. It's just that their opinion on it. And it can go either way, but I myself, the same as listening to Darren McCurry, as I had a little chuckle when I heard it. That was my attitude. I needed to go away and prove to them. I thought I was good enough. So I went back at my club, but we had a great autumn that year. We won the Dublin Club Championship and I played well. And just kind of, I had to look in the mirror myself as well. Like, and I'm sure Darren McCurry would say that. He's not sitting there going, I will tell Mickey Hart's fault that I didn't play in 2018. I'm sure there may be a couple of points they mightn't have agreed on totally, but Darren McCurry, there's no doubt, has gone away and worked on his own game as well. And I was a very similar situation. You got to look in the mirror first. There's no point pointing the finger at someone else until you have your house in order. And the accuracy with his shooting, his work rate, his sharpness on the ball, that's why I felt O'Hara probably wasn't the most suited to him. I just felt he was too sharp for him. And he's improved immensely. And when you do that and you put in the work, and then all of a sudden the coach comes in, and I was lucky, Jim Gavin came in for me a year later and backed me as well. Very similar to what's happened with McCurry. I didn't have a year like him now, to be honest, but it's a great story, and you love to see things like that. And it's a guy playing to his potential. And once you have confidence, and you can see the coaches have given him confidence, but there's no doubt the work he's done has given him confidence. He knows he can kick these scores. And that's hours and hours and weeks of practice up in Garvahy or wherever he's doing his kicking and his skills work. That's how you become the best version of yourself. And there's no doubt about it. Look, he's a nailed-on all-star. He's probably in the mix for player of the year as well. And that's a vindication, I'm sure, of his journey back from probably never playing inter-county football again only 3 years ago.
And Paddy, if a mic was stuck under your nose at the end of the 2013 All-Ireland final, would you have turned around and said, listen, I had to go away and I had to go and find the wolf?
Oh, yeah. I is the opposite. I had to lose the wolf. The wolf was the one that was getting me in trouble.
Sorry, Andy, I interrupted it.
I was opposite to the Dazzler in that regard now, yeah.
Those words. But I remember being up in... Joe, I remember Pete Donnelly telling me stories years ago about McCurry, just pitch, boom, 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 bag of balls coming in. I think at the time he was working with his dad on a building site or something, just straight in, bag of balls in the back of the van and just into the park every night, kicking.
Love that.
You know, and that's sometimes there's no real secrets to this, you know. It's and him going away and saying, I and needed to find a bit of dazzler. I think as every inside forward, I think we know what he means, Paddy. You need to be able to play with a bit of looseness and a bit of freedom. And he played with, like even the frees that he scored, he won us two frees. Like, he won two important frees for himself. Scored, I didn't think it was actually that good until I watched it back on the telly. He was excellent.
He was sharp. He was very sharp.
For the McShane goal, he wins the ball out in front of Lee and he puts somebody through. Do you know what I'm saying? He wins one out in the 45. That takes Lee Keegan out of that zone. Boom. Joe, it's very important.
That's the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy, which you can get wherever you get your podcasts. The best place to get it these days, of course, is the OTB Sports app. You can get it there, and the OTB Sports app will cost you nothing. So it's there for 24 hours before it is anywhere else as well. OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. It's 10 minutes past nine and there's some breaking news this morning. Chris Hughton has been sacked by Nottingham Forest. The writing was on the wall. I think particularly at the weekend, they had a lead at half time and they'd coughed up that lead, and then they were beaten by Middlesbrough 2-0 last night. Official statement on the Nottingham Forest website says Chris Hughton has been relieved of his duties. 6 defeats in 7 Sky Bet Championship matches. This is really unfortunate for Chris Hughton because he was putting together a really excellent career, and after the way he was treated at Newcastle, his reputation was excellent. He'd managed to do a good job there, did a good job at Brighton, and it's just unfortunate that Forest is a bit of a basket case and everybody who's gone in there has struggled.
Yeah, what a big club though. What a great club that it is. It's a shame because if you enjoy a bit of success there, no better place to be. So I understand what you're saying from the outside looking in. Seems to be the case in terms of the ownership of the club and the turnover in terms of managers. But I suppose you know what you're getting into. Chris would have known that when he went into the job, and he would have backed himself, but he also would have known if he didn't turn things around in a reasonably quick period of time, this was always going to be the inevitable outcome. And I suppose it's not a huge surprise when you look at the kind of run of form that they've been on. And I heard a couple of his comments the weekend. He was kind of sounding quite bullish and positive, which what you'd expect to hear from your manager, what the players would expect to hear from him kind of post-match. But I suppose this wouldn't be a huge surprise to Chris. So it's one of those things. The very best of managers go through these difficult experiences, so no difference in Chris's situation. I'm sure he'll be motivated to kind of bounce back. Might take a little bit of stock sometimes. People argue don't jump straight back in. Maybe the time of the year, well, it's so early in the season, maybe there'll be a couple of changes being made. Generally is, Jared, isn't there, kind of first couple of months
especially
of the season.
Especially in the Championship where there's so much money riding on the outcome.
Yeah, big expectation in terms of club challenge doesn't quite happen. Some vacancies do come about. Some people say don't take a step back for too long. People forget about you, the game moves on. Others will take a bit of time and make sure your next one's, you're right, when everybody will forgive you, like one bad experience that goes badly wrong. I don't think
so
Chris's
no impact.
Reputation will suffer it too much, but if you get the next one wrong, you choose the wrong club again and things go badly, then it maybe becomes a little bit of a struggle to bounce back from that.
Okay, and we were talking earlier on in the context of the FAI, they're not going to suddenly go, oh, Chris Hughton, former Ireland coach, former Ireland player, this is an opportunity for us to make a break. You don't see that as part of the dynamics of play?
I don't think so. But like I said, as we've spoken about already, whether that even becomes a conversation, I think will be dependent ultimately on what we see on the pitch from the players over the next couple of months. I think that will be a factor.
All right. OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Let's move on. Harriet Pryor of the Anfield Wrap is with us. Good morning to you, Harriet. How are you getting on?
Good morning. I'm very good, thank you. I can tell I've been on a European night at Anfield, but I feel good this morning.
Okay, well, that's good. What are the telltale signs as a matter of interest?
Just a little bit. No, I feel all right. I wasn't out till too late. I was very responsible. I've got work today. But no, we had a very good night last night. It was just great to be back at Anfield. It feels like it's been a really long time just waiting for a return to normality, and I think obviously the Premier League, that's been amazing to go back, but it just hits a bit different with the European night at Anfield. So very, very happy indeed.
Particularly one with a come from behind victory, that's the hallmark of those great European nights at Anfield, and it was all there, everything was there.
I know it really was. I was saying last night, I was doing a post-match show and I was saying I felt every single emotion during that 90 minutes and it had all the highs and all the lows. And reflecting, it probably would have been nice just to sit there and have a nice, easy 2-0 or 3-0 win. But that's not a proper European night, is it? It was great that we came from behind. We had that mad 5 minutes where it seemed to just all fall apart, and then going into half time I was a bit concerned, but then we came out second half fighting, and I think after Salah missed that penalty he was like, I am coming out and I'm scoring in the second half, and that's exactly what he did.
So when the penalty miss happens, what's Anfield like? How quiet is it?
You know what, I think I don't know how many people have been to Anfield, but it is one of the best places in the world in terms of getting behind their players. And obviously it goes a little bit moody for a few minutes, but then we're all just singing Mo Salah running down the wing and trying to get behind him and pick him back up. I think the atmosphere sort of dipped more when they did score the two goals in quick succession, but it did feel like a blow because we went 1-0 up, and then I thought we really needed to build and get that second goal. So having a chance like that, a penalty and not taking it, did feel like a missed opportunity, and it did prove to be at half time. But then, yeah, by the time the second half came, I think he managed to pick up his spirits. I think Klopp probably had a word with him and he was all right.
You guys obviously have your finger on the pulse of what the fans think. What do the fans think is the best team at the moment, particularly from a midfield perspective?
I think it's really hard because there was a lot of talk basically about the squad depth and whether we need to bring in more players and over the transfer window. And actually in midfield, it is one of the places where we can bring in different options and it does seem to work. But yeah, I think it was interesting last night that we didn't see Thiago until much later on in the game because for me, that midfield three of Thiago, Henderson and Fabinho was the one we all wanted to see last season and the one we thought would be our strongest. And we sort of haven't seen that as much. So yeah, we went with Keita last night, and I think you just adapt to your opponents and they all bring different challenges. And I all credit to AC Milan. They came to Anfield last night thinking they would pick up 3 points. And I think the logic with bringing Keita in was someone that would run at them and sort of provide a different challenge and one they maybe wouldn't be able to prepare for as well. And obviously it paid off. I thought Keita played well. But I think for me, I would like to see a bit more of Thiago, Henderson and Fabinho in midfield and then see if they really are our best three.
Obviously, everybody has endless faith in what Klopp is doing. Do you think Klopp has decided what his favourite trio is?
You know what? I don't think he really has, because I don't think there is one that will fit every single game. Like, when, you know, we're going to Norwich next week in the League Cup. He's not gonna start playing those players, is he? And he's not gonna decide they're the best three for those opponents. So I think he was playing Harvey Elliott loads, wasn't he? And no one would have said at the beginning of the season he would have been one of the favourites and the first to go. And obviously we've had the blow with him and the injury. But I don't think he knows in any given match who he really thinks the best three are. But I think he tries to just adapt it to the opponent and the challenges that they bring.
Can I ask you about the Trent Alexander-Arnold playing in midfield for England? And it seemed like that caused befuddlement and amusement amongst Klopp and the Liverpool fans in particular. Why so? I mean, full explainer here. I didn't watch that game, and I've definitely heard Trent Alexander-Arnold touted in previous years as a future midfielder at Liverpool and indeed England. So why now is it completely off the radar?
I think from a Liverpool fan's perspective, when you have the best, in our opinion, one of the best right backs in the world doing what he does, and his role is very specific, it's not sort of a traditional fullback role, the idea that you're moving him in position somewhere that he's never trained and never sort of played before. And I get that it was a good game to do it in, and I think a lot of Liverpool fans are happy that it happened in a game that didn't have any sort of repercussions on us. But why would you move him? And I think that's what Klopp found quite amusing, because he said he's so good at what he does, why take him out of that position? The logic I understand, because you're thinking maybe in midfield he'll get more time on the ball, he might be able to impact the game a bit more. But for me, the joy of him playing fullback is that he has the best of both worlds, and he can have that sort of extra second to be able to look up, take a bit more stock of what's going on the pitch. And in midfield, you're crowded straight away. You don't have that extra time on the ball. So where we play him and where we use him at Liverpool allows him to have his creative flair and step into those positions when he needs to. But it doesn't necessarily mean he needs to start there. So it's an interesting one. And maybe his game will develop over the years to come, and we don't know that. But for right now, I think But for us Liverpool fans, at least, we definitely just want to see him playing at right back. And I think that he should be playing that position in England, and that he's good enough to be playing that position for England.
What's your view on that, Kenny? Because there was definitely a school of thought when he broke into the Liverpool team that he's getting game time at right back at the moment to get him game time and to give him experience of playing in these big games. But ultimately, his best position is going to be in the middle of midfield because he has a skill set that very few people actually have.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily see that evolution. I agree a lot with Hardy said there. Clearly his best position isn't that right back area coming onto the ball. You can see all the play on your inside. He's been hugely effective in that respect. I didn't, a bit like yourself, Jay, I didn't understand the conversation around the England scenario. It was kind of totally different. A lot of games in different days, he wanted to get minutes on the pitch. Clearly he's reasonably comfortable in that area of the pitch. I don't think it was a big statement from Southgate that I see him.
And maybe in a tournament you might need him at some point.
Yeah, so I didn't understand the furority around that. I know a couple of Liverpool supporters are a little bit sensitive when you bring up the subject of Trent Alexander-Arnold. I'm at the moment having an argument, Harry, not an argument, a conversation with a Liverpool nut, and there's many of them, about that right back position, Trent, and is he the best fullback in the world? But of course, the discussion usually breaks into, well, let's break this down. Is he the best attacking fullback in the world, and likewise, is he the best defensive fullback in the world? And if you're going to regard yourself as the best right back in the world, you have to look at and talk about both of those aspects to your game. And even the game last night, Harry, if you look at assessing the two of the goals they conceded, the area of the pitch where they came from, it is amazing when I look at Trent sometimes. And when they're in possession of the ball, Harry, and he's driving forward, he looks like an athlete. When he's linking play up and he's joining in, he's getting on the overlap, he looks like a real athlete. He runs at pace, power, and takes your breath away. We know what his delivery's like. But you have a look at him, the ball goes behind him, and he's got to actually run in the opposite direction to the edge of his penalty box. He doesn't look as impressive. He finds it a little bit harder. And I just feel as if sometimes, whether that kind of that enthusiasm that he has, that kind of focus and the quality which he possesses in possession, when his team's in possession, he's getting himself involved in attacking areas. I don't get a sense if he has that real kind of hunger and that focus when it comes to the defensive side to his game. I think we saw a small element of that last night in terms of how they conceded the goals, and also previously. Now, this isn't like, let's jump on Trent Alexander-Arnold, like, instead throwing punches, but I think it has to come into the argument in terms of when you're assessing someone as being the best right back in the world. Why isn't he playing for England? It's a joke that Southgate doesn't play him. There's clearly reasons why Southgate doesn't play him, and I think it is the defensive aspects to his game and those kind of concentration levels and decision making when he's in and around his own penalty box. Don't know how Harry feels about, or how Liverpool supporters, if they're that blinkered or that blinded by the qualities which he has, that they won't even engage in a conversation that, you know, attempts to maybe criticise him ever so slightly in terms of that part of his game.
I'm happy to engage in a conversation 100%. I think there's a few things for me, and the first is that when you're talking about him being the best, I think we're talking about a very specific role, because let's not get this wrong. He's redefined what it means to be a fullback, and there's that famous Carragher quote: "No one grows up wanting to be a fullback." And I think with the introduction of Trent and Robertson and what they've done in the context of that position, people do. And I don't think any of us are blinkered for a second. I think we're all very happy to be critical of our own players and look at areas that they can improve. Obviously, one that you've mentioned there and picked up on there is his defensive abilities, all I will say is the style of football that we play is riskier in terms of they play a very high line. That's why we have the holding midfielders Fabinho and Henderson dropping back a little bit so that they can provide the cover for Trent, because we allow Trent and Robertson to push forward, and that's just the style of games that we play. We know that means maybe one time out of 10 he will get caught out on the defensive duties, but that's the kind of risk that we take, and that's the game style we play because of how many chances and opportunities that he creates. And that goal last night wasn't given to him, but we all know that that's Trent's goal and the one that he created. So I think that honestly that is just the style of football we play. And then on your point about England, and if he was the best right back he would be slotting into the England side, I think you can't compare like for like, because they just play two completely different styles of football. In my view, Southgate, for all his great sort of assets, he doesn't exactly know how to use Trent. And that's the thing. He's not sure what to do with him. And that's why he's experimenting and, you know, completely happy with him experimenting and doing what he wants to do. But I don't think you can talk about he should definitely be getting his position in England, because they just don't play the same style of football that England that Liverpool do. Sorry. And I don't think they want to either, because I don't think that Southgate's going to put an England team out that plays such a high pressing attacking game. And that is more risky and leaving a few more holes in defence. But yeah, I'll stop in a minute, but I've just got to defend him, because you can't say a guy that young, you know, with a Champions League medal and a Premier League medal, it's got too many flaws. I think we all back him, and we know that he is capable both going forward and tracking back and defending.
Well, Jimmy Traore had a Champions League medal. I could pick a few flaws in his game as well.
The Jimmy Traore is definitely comes up in these arguments a lot. Who's better than Kenny? What right backs are?
Could I ask Harry one more thing, change the conversation a little bit? What's the consensus amongst Liverpool supporters in terms of Jurgen Klopp binning those traditional glasses that he used to wear? Because it's a really unusual sight now. That camera goes in close on the touchline. It still throws me that I don't see those bins on his head. I don't know what it is. It's just I haven't quite adjusted to it.
None of us are used to it. Yeah, I think it's going to take a little while to get used to. But to be honest, I think he broke these glasses so many times in celebrations that he thought, I just need to get rid of these. I need to do something about it. So I think he used lockdown as an opportunity to sort something else out, another option. So it's taking a bit of getting used to. But if that's Klopp's new look, then we're all behind
it. It's a bit like Trent's crossfield passes. Those raking 50-yard passes. It's a given, you know what I mean? Klopp's glasses, look, is there in those bracket,
exactly.
Like, you know what I mean?
As the glasses were, are you jealous about what's going on at the club? Is that it? Harry, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us. Before I let you go, actually, I did want to ask you about the women's team. There's significant investment and hopes that they're going to be able to make it into the WSL with promotion. A lot of Irish interest, obviously. Niamh Fahey, Megan Campbell and Leanne Kiernan at the moment. Fahey sent off at the weekend, so things not going brilliantly at the moment.
I think, to be honest, there's such a change of personnel and with the new, the returning manager, Matt Beard, coming in, it's more, we all knew that it was going to take a little bit of time for him to be able to put his mark on the game and to be able to make an impact. Things will continue to progress. I think they've had a first few tricky games. I've been to the first two home games at Prenton Park, and obviously they won away from home, but they've not done as well at home yet. So there's been some really bright performances, though. I think Rhianna Dean is a new player, a new striker that's come in, and she's looked really promising. I think there's a few other players on the pitch that look like they've been brought in for a specific reason, and they're doing really well. So I have faith in them. Obviously, we all know the goal is getting them back in the WSL. That is where they belong. And it's a real shame that they're not there, and you have the men's team who are winning Premier League trophies and Champions League trophies, and the women's team are getting relegated. It's not a great look, obviously, and I think that the club have recognised that, and they are trying to put more investment into the women's team now, and hopefully it does pay off. But I think we expect it to take maybe a couple of seasons rather than an immediate solution, bringing in a new manager and loads of new players and thinking that it will all just click, because I think we know from experience that sometimes it takes a bit more time.
All right, Harry, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us. Cheers.
Thank you. Bye.
Harry Pryor from the Anfield Wrap there. OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward. They're new and improved razors. Here's what we got on OTB Sports Radio today. OTB Gold at 1 o'clock is the story of Declan Murphy, his book Centaur. Live from 2, it is our NFL show. It's called The Snap. Our History of Sport lecture series from Paul Rouse at 3. Ireland versus England 1995, the retro panel. I think Bernard O'Byrne is part of that one. OTB Gold is Jerry Eisenberg, Muhammad Ali at 6. And live the show tonight with Nathan and John Giles and all the rest. Up next, though, we're talking to Sue about the new Michael Schumacher documentary. Stay tuned.
OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the OTB Sports app.
Okay, it's time for us to talk about our weekly TV picks. Sue Murphy is here with us. Sue, good morning to you.
Hey, how are you?
Good. We're talking Michael Schumacher, and the new documentary is out on Netflix on Friday. You've seen it?
Yeah, I've seen it. Actually, it came out last night. I thought it was at the end of the week, but it came out last night. So I'd say some people have already dipped into it, because there's a lot of people waiting to see this. I've been barred from talking about this around the house because I got a little bit too obsessed with it. I watched a lot of Formula One when he was driving, and there was just always this obsession with Schumacher and what kind of person he was. He wanted to know more about him, and I think he was quite private about his family. Obviously, a workaholic, was obsessed with making Ferrari work when he went to Ferrari. And I think this is an amazing insight into his life and the kind of person he was. Huge family man, and just like an obsession with always being right about things and always getting something right. And I just think at what's happening with him now at the moment, they haven't really given that much away in the documentary, and that's fine. I think it's definitely, if you are a fan of him, it's going to give you more of an insight into his life, but also just the family want to protect him. And his wife says, Corinna says in the documentary, you know, he always protected us when he was really, really famous, and now we're protecting him. And they don't want to release details, and that's fine. I think there's this obsession with finding out about how Michael Schumacher is and how he's doing, and I don't think we're entitled to know that information. I mean, everything that happened afterwards with the skiing accident and everything, it wasn't even on a Formula One circuit. It's just a bit invasive, and I feel like this is for the fans. This is like, here's what he's like, here's what he was like to live with, here's what he's like as a dad. We're mad about him, we love him so much, please respect our privacy. And it's just very touching. It's a lovely tribute to a complete champion.
It's very long. It's an hour and 52 minutes.
Didn't feel it. Honestly, didn't feel it. Like, I think the great thing about Formula One is they film every single second of everything that's happening around every circuit. It's just, there's so much footage they could put into this. And they have a lot of family videos in this, images, home footage, and they stitch it all together really, really nicely. I just think it's one of the good sports documentaries I've seen. And it, instead of just, the best ones are ones that tell a story as opposed to being about the sport. And they really tell a story about a man. And it's just, at the end of the day, he's a dad and he's a husband, and they've lost him. And that's actually very painful to watch. So I really can't recommend it enough. I thought it was brilliant.
Okay. Any specific insights into the rivalries around the time that made him great? Any of that kind of, like...
With everyone. Like, they just all talk about how obsessed he was with beating all of them. Like, Hill is one of the ones that's featured. They talk to him. They talk to Mika Hakkinen, who just seems like the nicest man ever. And David Coulthard. And the Coulthard insight is amazing, because he was quite friendly with Coulthard. There's footage of them singing karaoke together, which I didn't know they were that close. And he talks about the race in 98 when Schumacher was trying to take him over in the rain, and he drove into the back of him. And Coulthard, they had a massive row afterwards in the pits, and all of the camera crew and everything would follow them. And afterwards, Coulthard said to him, you know, sometimes you're wrong, Michael. And he was like, not that I can remember. And Coulthard laughs it off, because he's kind of like, that's just the way he was. But the rivalries always seem to be so respectful. Like the whole thing with Senna as well, in the year Senna died and the year he won the world championship, he obviously took that quite to heart, because he broke down at that news conference a few years later when he broke Senna's record. And it's just, they have so much respect for him, but also what a crazy guy, you know, that kind of like, he was just obsessed with the sport. And it is like, the interviews are just spectacular.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a recommendation.
Oh yeah. I would, even if you're not into Formula One, the story of him is just so interesting.
Are you into Formula One, Kenny? You getting into?
Do you know what? How's it going, Sue? Yeah, it's interesting. I was in my early years, used to follow kind of religiously. A lot of people are kind of my generation did. But I'll be honest, I kind of fell out of love with it like some years ago.
I played in the Schumacher era, because it got too boring, where it was like Schumacher's going to win, and then it's a battle for second amongst a bunch of people who are in inferior cars and can't get close to him. And then everybody's back into it now because of Drive to Survive.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say into that, the last kind of 18 months, so yeah, just stumbled upon a few recommendations from people in terms of Netflix and, of course, the Formula One series, jumped on that, and that was like, oof, wow, this is interesting. Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, fully engaged again. And the individuals, really, so I suppose the personalities, you're talking about the human element there in terms of Schumacher's documentary. Well, that Formula One Netflix one, now we're learning about the individuals themselves, their kind of personalities, little quirks, you know, how things function in the garage, etc. You know, the dynamics between people, owners and drivers, mechanics, etc. So, yeah, I must admit, and maybe this documentary in itself, I might get around to looking at. I must admit, so I wouldn't be immediately drawn to it just because of
I think you'll love it.
Yeah, just his personal situation, really. Like, for the reasons that you're saying, really, so it's such a personal thing for the family, what they've gone through and what they're going through and what they continue to kind of go through. I just feel as if sometimes, it, yeah, you spoke about being invasive. That's kind of how I feel, that I don't really have the right. I never thought that. I heard people talking about, oh, it'd be great to see him. Like, maybe will he talk, see what condition he's in? But you never felt that was going to be the case. There was going to be that kind of access to Schumacher as he is. He's obviously still physically, mentally not at the level that he was, but for you're saying, for the Schumacher fans, for Formula One fans in general, yeah, I think just those kind of personal little anecdotes people will find kind of very interesting. They might feed off that a little bit, but I must admit, personally myself, I'm always a little bit generally take a step back a little bit in these situations rather than the Formula One. I was all in straight away, and I must admit it has kind of triggered those old memories from back in the day when I wouldn't go as far as to say I was in love with it, but
there was nothing else
every
on.
Weekend that was it. You were you were on it. You were all over it. Like, so.
Yeah. No. It's fair enough. Okay. So, Help is new and shiny. What's this?
Yeah, this is on Channel 4 tomorrow night. I don't think people are going to find this an easy watch, but I thought it was brilliant. I actually managed to get to the end eventually. It's on at 9 o'clock tomorrow night, Channel 4. It stars Jodie Comer. She plays a care worker who gets a job in a local care home in Liverpool just before the pandemic. And basically, she's asymptomatic when COVID hits the care home. A lot of people end up going out sick or in quarantine. A lot of the people who are in the home end up dying. And it's basically her watching half the care home die in front of her and trying to take care of them. And it's a difficult, there's 15, 20 minutes in the middle of this where she's trying to keep one of her patients alive. She can't get a hospital. She can't get a bed. She can't get an ambulance. She's trying to contact everyone in the local area to see if there's anyone that can bring this poor man to... He needs a ventilator. He's not going to be able to breathe. She's trying to turn him over. She's listing patients in the care home to help her, even though they can't go into the room because of COVID. And it's honestly so traumatic, 15, 20 minutes. And you get to the end and it shows all the stats about, you know, 10% of the PPE that they needed was given to them in the first few weeks. A care worker in the UK is paid $8.50 an hour. Like, what they went through was unbelievable. And I think it's just very honest account of here's how hard it was. Here's how hard it was for these people who were taking care of these people. I think if this came out at the start of the pandemic, there wouldn't be questions about why do we have to stay at home? Or it would just be, okay, but that's why we need to stay at home, because we need to look after these people. It is absolutely heartbreaking. Difficult watch. She is amazing in it.
Okay.
But I don't know if it's going to be for everyone because it's tough.
Thursday night on Channel 4. It's called Help. We've only got about 2 minutes left here. Something entirely different is the third season of Sex Education on Netflix.
I love it. It's just like turn your brain off TV. And it's like, I think a lot of parents who are watching this are going to be like, what the hell are my teenagers up to? And they are doing everything that's in the show. So I hope they enjoy that. But the main guy in it, Otis, is his mom is played by Gillian Anderson. She's a sex therapist who he's constantly embarrassed by. And he becomes a kind of a sex therapist in the school. He starts answering questions to kids. He ends up setting up a sex clinic in the school to answer questions for kids. And it's just really, really enjoyable. And I thought it was going to be one of those things that if you're not in school at the time, you're not going to get all the quirks and how funny it is. But
it's pretty
because
good.
They lace. Yeah, I really like it. And it's not brilliant TV. It's not going to change your life, but it is nice to watch. And the characters are also all really likable. I'm just very fond of it. I think it's good.
Okay.
Third season is good as well.
Right. In the last minute, Kin
on RTE1, really surprised by how good that was, actually. But I think the cast, kind of like Ciarán Hinds, put Ciarán Hinds in anything. He's only in about three scenes in the first episode, but he's so good. And it kind of revolves around the Kinsella family, who are a gang in Dublin, and how they're trying to bring their brother back in, who's just out of prison. Something happens in the end of the first episode that's going to change everything. And do you know what? It's good. It doesn't look too flashy. It makes Dublin look amazing, but at the same time, not too flashy. And it's just a good, like, it's a good family drama, which you need to have at the centre of those kind of gangster things.
All right. Good stuff, Sue. Thanks a million.
Thanks a million.
Best of luck.
See you later.
Cheers, sir.
Bye.
Bye. That is Sue's last one for a little while with us, but we'll obviously be back.
Family?
Sooner
family
rather than later.
I didn't say it myself, but.
Kin.
Speaking to somebody was, oof.
Which?
Tough watch. Kin, was that the Irish there?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just when Sue said family, I'm thinking, well, two 10-year-olds and the man that sat on the sofa. I don't know, did you see it?
No, I haven't. I don't think it's for you. I don't think you're supposed to be watching it. You're 10-year-old.
Oh, so, well, so she said family.
She meant as it's a drama about the family.
Oh, about the family.
Yeah,
oh,
like
right.
The Sopranos is a family drama. Yeah. But you're not watching that with your kids, right?
Oh, right. Gotcha. Yeah, yeah. Probably done you a favour mentioning that, just bringing it up. That's how I took it.
Okay.
I know the kids are pretty battle hardened around the streets of Dublin, but that might be a push.
Too much. Absolutely too much. Kenny, good stuff. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Cheers, yeah.
You're Champions League winner at this point after the first week.
No.
Far too early in the season, but come on.
Yeah, you've just given me.
I've not told you to it. Don't
far
worry.
Far too early. You've just said
it's Liverpool, isn't it?
I haven't even thought about it.
It's
hard.
Chelsea.
Oof.
Back to back.
Yeah.
It's too hard to go back to back unless you're. Do you know what? I was actually surprised by how resolute Real Madrid were, and I think Vinicius is reaching a level where he could be a global superstar, and actually they might be okay. They might be one of the teams who squirt out of the difficulties they're in at the moment.
Interesting. Wouldn't agree with it, but yeah.
Okay, that can be your homework. You're back in with us next Wednesday. I'm going to ask you that question at the start of the show next Wednesday. Who's going to win the Champions League? Reminder, OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette, with your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Tomorrow morning, it's Adrian Barry and Aisling O'Reilly hosting. We've got rugby with Alan Quinlan, Celtic with Enda Call, and Nicky Daly joins us to talk to us about Formula Female.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.